Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Okay, I don't know if anybody heard me yelling out that my water container wasn't even full. Because my mic went on early. There's a 30-second apparently the show is 30 seconds ahead of the clock. It's like, I had less time than I thought I did. Anyway, so maybe it made it on, maybe it didn't. But that's the beauty of Action Radio. It's whatever happens. I just let it go. You know, it goes into the mix. You know, we had dogs yesterday barking. We had, what else did we have? All kinds of other sound effects. That's what makes the show fun. Anything in the background, people talking, laughing, it all gets thrown into the mix. But I just realized that I forgot to fill me a my wonderful stainless steel water container. And I can only do the show so long without water. Now, I've got some. I've got a little bit in here, but not as much as I need. So at some point, I'm going to take a break, actually mute myself this time so you don't hear me running across the kitchen, grabbing a water, splashing it, and running back here, sitting down going, ah, that was how my Friday could start. So this is how we do it. We're coming off an incredible series of shows this week, especially yesterday. And I know this is confusing for some people, the way that we're structuring the time now, because it was 7 to 9 for the good, I think the first three or four years. And then I went to 3 hours, and I went 6 to 9, and then I switched it, a couple months ago, maybe even more recently, maybe like in the last few weeks, to 7 to 10 a.m. And then, of course, Friday, we still have to start early because I want to get Shirley Watchell and Jim Dykes together, A, because they're friends, and B, because they're really good together, overlapping the reports, and C, they both talk about guns. And so Shirley does the D.C. Project Report, Women and Guns, and Jim Dykes does the Second Amendment Report, and he's a director of Florida Carry. So it just makes sense to keep them together. But just the way it works out, the only way it can do that and keep Derek Park, who does our financial report, and have him at his regular time, is to start the show at 6 o'clock. Now, the good news for me is that my weekend starts an hour earlier, but of course, my weekends are filled with getting the next week's shows ready, so it's kind of a busy time. So a lot's been going on. Yesterday especially, we had the most amazing panel. We had the most amazing panel the week before, and I honestly thought that maybe, you know, I'm asking too much of these folks. It's a three-hour show to have them all on, but I really think they enjoyed it as much as I did. I mean, the panel was incredible. We had Dr. Judy Mikovits. We had Dr. Brian Artis. Dr. Ben Marble was busy with stuff. He couldn't make it yesterday, which I bet he's, you know, really upset with, because he would have been great yesterday. And our other folks, let me see, Dr. Jim Thorpe. So Thorpe, Mikovits, Artis, and Marble, those are the four regular panelists. And then we add to them. And the first show a week ago, we had Christina, what's her last name? I forgot. Anyway, I'll get her. North something. And we had Tiffany Prada. And although I'm screwing up their names, I'm sure I'm going to see if I can get them back, because I want those two along with our two guests from yesterday. And that was John Cullen, who's the data guy. He's Oracle. He analyzes data like nobody I've ever seen. And he's the one that did the John Hopkins map, the actual map that you see with the COVID, you know, number of deaths around the world. That was him. Okay, he did that. And then we had Patrick Wood yesterday, and Patrick does the Technocracy website. So his fascination and study are these dangerous, evil, you know, techno-bureaucrats. The technocracy is the merging of technology and bureaucracy. That's literally what it means. And what they're all is what we call sustainable growth. In other words, no growth, managed growth. They sustained by them. Okay, if you want to put it bluntly. So they're the ones actually sustaining it. And if they're going to be sustaining it, then they're going to say how much growth there is. And actual fact, there's none. And so are these folks managing the resources, you know, in a way that's cutting back on our resources? You know, they don't like fossil fuels, but, you know, Patrick made a point that I've made in shows that oil doesn't come from fossils. Never, you know, maybe some, you know, maybe some, you know, billion amounts of algae and, you know, plant material, but there certainly aren't enough dinosaurs to fuel the Industrial Revolution and the current needs, you know. So it's got to come from somewhere. It's not coming from fossils. It's coming from the Earth. The Earth makes hydrocarbons. I mean, part of our Earth includes hydrogen and carbon. Carbon's the basis of life. And, you know, between carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen create carbohydrates, which are sugars. Well, that gives us energy. Hydrocarbons, you know, without oxygen create petroleum, and that gives us energy. Coincidence? No. They both burn, you know. And what happens when hydrocarbons burn? Well, they create, you know, they bond with oxygen and they get H2O and CO2, carbon dioxide and water. That is a typical product. When you burn hydrocarbons, they bond with oxygen and create water and carbon dioxide. Well, carbon dioxide is necessary for the plants to breathe. So the carbon dioxide that we are releasing by burning petroleum, coal, and you know, organic compounds like that, it goes back into the air. Well, the air that makes it available for plants, which then we assume maybe, you know, at some point end up as oil. So the carbon is trapped in the plants and then has to be released. Well, how it gets released is burning petroleum. Okay. So burning petroleum, I'm going to talk to Gregory Wrightstone about this. I think it's going to make for a very interesting guest hour sometime. But it makes sense to me that this is what's going on, that we're actually replenishing the carbon cycle, that there's nothing unnatural about burning petroleum at all. In fact, the earth makes it. Well, where's it going to go if we don't burn it? You know, maybe, just maybe, in the intelligent design of Earth, Earth has been making oil for millions, billions of years. Maybe the whole point of discovering the internal combustion engine was so that we could replenish the CO2 supply, and maybe actually the burning of fuel in our vehicles as we're having fun and driving our 61 Corvettes actually is to replenish the carbon in the air. Maybe we're supposed to put it there. And you never hear that from the scientists. Well, first of all, they don't believe in God, the government scientists. They believe in government. That's their God, obviously by what they talk about. Now, if you listen to the show yesterday, you'll notice that every one of those folks has a strong belief in God, that we are not the highest power in the world, that there is a power above us. You know, that's where our rights come from. That's where our knowledge comes from. That's where the design of the earth comes from. And the more you mess with it and screw it up, you know, the more you screw up the human body with chemicals, vaccines, different agents, bioweapons, things like that, the more you mess up everybody's life, and people are dying earlier. I mean, the lifespan is decreasing, not increasing. This is the first time in history. It's a decrease. Usually it's increasing. Then it started at a pretty low level, like what, 30? You know, most people in the early times, you know, several thousand, you know, a couple thousand years ago, they were dead at 30. But that's, you know, those are bad times. I'd be curious what the lifespan was of people 40,000 and 60,000 years ago. It would be very interesting. You know, the first thing you think of is like, you know, tooth decay. But when they didn't have sugar, you know, how much tooth decay was there? I mean, they used, you know, hazelnuts and various, you know, sugar canes, but that was natural then, okay, as opposed to artificial refined sugar, which is in everything now, which is totally dangerous. All right. So I got two themes that I wanted to cover today. One is the fact that masculine men have been removed under this so-called toxic masculinity. And what you've got is a bunch of girly. You've got girly men running around. You've got girly men in the government. You've got girly men in the corporations. You've got girly men everywhere. And quite frankly, they're useless. They're like drones. They're like, you know, castrated males. They don't serve a function. You know, they don't. I mean, I'm not saying I want any harm to cover them. I'm just saying that they're, you know, in terms of society and progress and, you know, you need feminine women and masculine men. I mean, that's just what makes the world go round. You know, one of the revelations that came out yesterday is the fact that the fertility rate of the world has dropped incredibly. And part of the problem, you know, female hormones have dropped, male hormones have dropped, sperm counts ridiculously low. And guys, we're going to do a whole show on this. Guys are stopping interested in sex, which is staggering. You know, because I'm in my 60s, and, you know, that thought crosses my mind, you know, unless I'm thinking of something else, like, you know, guns, guitars, airplanes, things like that, pretty much constantly. And so, but that's, you know, but I obviously, you know, my generation's testosterone is higher than the one after me, and then certainly the one after that, which is kind of staggering when you think about it. What's wrong with these guys? You take a video game over a hot babe? What's wrong with you people? Anyway, so we've lost our masculinity, and part of masculinity means being a strong man, which is attractive to strong women. And that's what makes the world go around, folks. You know, you try and deny it all you want. That's you know, that's where we are. And if we break that cycle, if we have girly men and, I don't know, feminized, distraught females, we got a problem. And so the biggest, you know, the most immediate reference to this is what happened in Uvalde, where you had a gutless, gender-neutral police chief or someone there ordered the police to stand down and wait. Okay, well, real men don't stand down and wait. In fact, I'm sort of saving a story for when Shirley gets here. It's kind of interesting, actually. I'll save it for that because it's going to be – I want her reaction to it. But real men, you know, now, does that say they go in blindly and stupidly? No. But the people that went in and stopped the assassin in Uvalde, they did that against orders. They were ordered not to go in. Now, what kind of girly man orders men not to go in and save children? So that's where the investigation needs to be. And if you want to find out, you know, everybody going, you know, of course, the left uses any excuse to get guns. So let's put that aside. We know they're going to do that. All right. So my defense against that is an offense against that. Pro-gun bills. Bills promoting silencers so you don't lose your hearing when you defend your life. Bills that give tax credits and tax deductions for purchasing ammunition. We might even have a voucher program. In fact, I wrote one. You know, gun stamps, which is like food stamps for low-income people, so they can have access to their constitutional and civil rights. In fact, we have a bill that makes gun ownership a civil right, and that would allow penalties for those that discriminate against that right. And so we're going to talk about – I've got a couple of folks that Cheryl Todd's going to be on the show. She has her own gun show, I mean, literally a show, media show, you know, and so she'll be on, I think, in a week. Oh, I've got to check my calendar. We're going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about that with Shirley today in the D.C. project. Jim Dyke, same thing. I'm hoping that these groups will start sponsoring our legislation. We've got a bill that reverses the background check so that you're actually checking the people on the prohibited list, not everybody else. Okay, and that, of course, that gets rid of any possibility of registration and future confiscation, which is what the government seems to be into. But the biggest problem is, you know, no problem is, there's no single thing. You know, the left says, well, blame guns. Okay, really, what, this inanimate object, you know, sitting in my gun safe that's going to get up on its own and start doing things? No, it's not. You know, it takes a person to pull a trigger, okay? That's how they're supposed to work, right? So the only thing I would say on gun safety is that the guns themselves have to work as intended. If they have a safety, the safety has to work. If it's a revolver, the trigger, you know, is harder to pull. There's your safety. The biggest safety is your brain. Okay. So if guns work as intended, they have to fire to save your life. You know, the biggest thing is to be reliable. You know, so if someone misuses it or carelessly uses it or irresponsibly uses it, it's still going to fire. Why? Why? Because it has to be made to save someone's life, not for the irresponsible person. That's not how it works. So anyway, getting back to our theme here that we have castrated men in terms of, you know, emotions, mental capacity, attitude and everything out. We got a bunch of this is what I call the Republicans, the grand old party. I call them the gelding old party. And a gelding is a castrated horse. I seem to be on a theme today with this this, you know, lack of masculinity, but it seems to be pervasive. You know, we've men, and so, you know, as regular guys, and I'm not, you know, Joe Pro jock, football hero, you know, combat veteran decorated with medals and things. I'm not. I'm a regular guy, but I got the attitude. I definitely have. I was a flight instructor. Trust me. You know, you can't be a wimp and be a flight instructor. That includes men and women. You can't. Trust me. Get into an airplane with a stranger and go flying around and doing steep turns and stalls and slow flight and landings and flying in crosswinds and all the things we fly. To me, it was just an adventure. I loved it. I was single. I didn't have any dependents. You know, I had yet to get married and have my daughter. And so I didn't care, much like now, because my daughter's an adult. I don't care. You know, I'm in a position where if the worst happens to me, you know, I'm not leaving anybody behind who's stranded. So it's kind of a nice position to be in. So now I don't care. So danger, whatever danger Action Radio brings me, you know, when we take on the powers that be, is when this show gets 10 million listeners. And we're going to, you know, there's going to be, well, I'll get the death threats. I'll get everything else like that. But quite honestly, you know, I've already made that decision that whatever happens, happens. I'm still going to carry on. I'm still going to fight for freedom. You know, in the time that God gives me, I'm going to do as much as I can for freedom. Anyway, hopefully that's I believe that is a masculine attitude. As opposed to a girly man, you know, I want to be safe. If one more person wishes me to be safe, I'm going to scream. Because quite frankly, safety is up to you. You know, so it shouldn't be safe. It should be make yourself safe. And if you want to wish somebody something, you wish that they make themselves safe. Well, how do you make yourself safe? Well, you know, you learn how to drive in rain and snow, and you know, you learn how to protect yourself and your family. You learn how to shoot guns, and you learn how to be financially, you know, savvy, and learn some legislation, learn some history, know what your rights are, things like that. I mean, that's how you protect yourself. So Miranda Devine, who I really want to get on the show, she's Australian. She's I think she's either the editor or owner or something of the New York Post. Let's check the byline here. Miranda Devine, what a great name too. And she has, well, let's see if I do my Australian accent. G'day, yeah, she's got an Australian accent. I used to have one. This is the sad. I used to have an Australian accent. Miranda Devine. Where is that, the singer at the bottom? They don't do bylines anymore? Comments. Okay, fine. All right. So I can't find her byline, but I know she's high up in the New York Post. So let's get back to the top of the article. And this is written recently. Miranda Devine, New York Post, opinion, June 1st. So yesterday. No, 2 days ago. I'm sorry. Anyway, so here's what she says. Where are the men of courage? They're gone thanks to toxic masculinity. Yeah, see, this is what happens. We talked about this yesterday, too. This is what happens when you have a school. No, was it yesterday or the day before? Oh, it was with Lisa Babbage, who's an educator. And she talked about teachers, and, you know, and she always referred to the feminine, she. You know, when the teachers, you know, when they are, you know, the mothers and nurses and things that are teachers, they say, wait a minute, you seem to be a one-sided gender here, you know, and they say, well, there's no men, you know, teaching in the elementary schools. Well, I said, think about that. You know, you've got a ridiculous amount of single mothers because of the Great Society program of government paying to break up families, you know, to cast men aside. You've got no men at home for fathers for role models. You've got no men in the schools for males for role models. In fact, you're especially for young boys, you're actually depriving them of critical. You know, trust me, anybody who's ever been in the Boy Scouts and had, like I had a lot of teachers when I went to Australia. In fact, they're all male teachers, except one. You know, so I get a good exposure to male role models from the age of 8 years old when I got to Australia. Because I went to a boys' school, so the boys, you know, we had girls, but at that age, they really didn't care. So, you know, they're there for me. Those years, girls were just weird. We didn't know quite where girls were. It's just one of those things, young boys, you know. But like I said, when I was five, I had my first crush. But that was different, you know, and there's some gap in the middle where you do like the guy thing, you do the Boy Scouts, you do the sports and all that kind of stuff. And girls kind of disappear for a while, as I'm sure, you know, boys disappear for girls at that age. And then somewhere along the way, you know, puberty, things like that, the hormones kick in and all of a sudden, oh, where have you been the last 4 years, you know, and things change. But that step is missing now. And so you look at the schools, and you look at the teachers, and you look at the lack of men, you know, everywhere. And where do boys get their impressions of what men are? What, sports, entertainment? It's entertaining. It's supposed to be entertaining. Now I'm looking at the New York Post. They got a headline, trans swimmer, you know, teammate slams. I'll have to read that. First of all, the trans swimmer, I don't believe in transgender. It's an attitude. It's a personal problem, not a civil right. And so I don't really use the term transgender. I'm referring to Republican rhinos, who I call transgender Democrats, which seems to be appropriate to me. But the first thing is you call her Mike, not Leah, and he's a guy. So it's not a transgender female. He's a guy. I don't care what he's done to his body. And it looks kind of disgusting, actually. You know, he's sort of become this halfway in between thing, which is really stupid. You know, but it's that's that. Just as people change their names so they could qualify for affirmative action. You know, now people are changing their body to fit a civil rights category, which is really sick. Anyway, Brenda Devine says, so we will vilify action men, brand chivalry and valor, toxic masculinity, stamp on the manly virtues that made civilization possible. Yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, she's got a picture of Vivaldi of the men standing around while children were being shot to death. She says, then we are shocked when armed cops stand around outside a classroom while children are slaughtered. You know, it's pretty much what I just said. Or when strap hangers, I'm not sure what that is, watch passively as a woman is assaulted on the subway. Oh, strap hangers. I guess those are that hang under the rubber handles. We had metal ones in San Francisco, but yeah, I never heard that term, strap hangers. And then she says, what is the answer? Democrats cynically demonize Republicans over guns as a motivator for their base. Republicans fall back on hardening security to prevent more school shootings. But little Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, where an 18-year-old gunman, which I would call a murderer, not a gunman, I hate that term. It's not true. He's an assassin. He's a murderer. You know, the gun was the tool. The gun was the implement. But the intent and the person and the will to do it was in the person. So let's call him 18-year-old assassin, murdered 19 small children and two of their teachers last week, was already pretty hardened. Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District had its own 6 strong police force. Oh, really? Where were they? Armed security guards, perimeter fencing, and a locked classroom policy, according to a security plan posted on its website. Well, I guess that wasn't followed. She says, still, the shooter found an unlocked door, and the only thing that might have saved those children were men of courage and action rushing into the line of fire. Yes, men. Well, it's a simple fact, folks. Okay, let's, you know, the people that are most likely to run in. Now, I'm not saying women don't, but, you know, you put 100 men and 100 women together, random men, random women in a group, and say there's a dangerous, active shooter inside there. Do something. All right, who's going to run in? It's mostly going to be the guys. That's just, you know, and that's okay. You know, we protect women and we make guys courageous, and there's reasons for that. That's how society works, okay? Anyway, so she says, instead, they had armed police officers milling around outside their classrooms, reportedly for over an hour, as blood flowed unchecked and innocent souls rose to heaven. If you were the desperate parents prevented by cops from going inside the school to save your kids, your rage would be rightly insatiable. Let me talk about this for a second, too, because this is really critical. That not only are men being demonized and little boys are being told about their toxic masculinity, men are actually prevented from going. In fact, women were prevented from going in, too. There's some brave women. There's one woman who got handcuffed, talked her way out of the handcuffs, jumped the fence, got her kids out of her classroom, which was fortunately not the one that the assassin was in. Good for her. I guess, give her a medal. And I don't think women are courageous. Trust me, I flew with a combat trauma nurse, one of my favorite students. We went into the worst weather, whatever situation I could put her in, and she was fine. And she was probably my bravest, one of my best students ever. It's not the idea that a woman can't do it. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the preponderance is, and the burden is, and the responsibility is on men to be courageous. That's our job. Okay. It's your job, guys. All right. Face it. That's what you're supposed to do. If you can't do that, that's fine. Just go be a girly man and go somewhere else. But don't join the police force. If you're a girly man, don't join the police force. If you're a wimpy woman, don't join the police force. Don't do it. Anyway, so this is part of so the only thing that's toxic about masculinity is the toxic destruction of masculinity. That's what the problem. So it's not toxic men. It's the toxicity that has destroyed men. That's the dark side of feminism. Feminism, as far as equality goes, is absolutely for and still am. Okay. When women couldn't get credit cards if they were married unless their husband signed it, that's insane. When women couldn't start businesses, when women, let's go back and when women didn't vote, crazy. Okay. You've got to have equality. However, when you get beyond equality to privilege, that's where the problem comes in. So now we have a segregation of privilege as opposed to segregation of punishment. Looks like Pianki wants to weigh in on this before Shirley gets. Let me bring him on and talk about another masculine man, the virile, the independent, the courageous Pianki, my co-host. Hey, Pianki.
Hey, Greg. How you doing this morning?
I'm still on a roll from yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the show, and it probably surprised a lot of people. We start at 10 o'clock, but we do that to accommodate all our folks across the country, particularly Judy, who's in California. I'm doing great. But let's ask you the same question. Toxic men, the boys two generations down from you and me, they're a bunch of wimps.
Well, yeah, you have some that seem that way. But I kind of have mixed feelings on police officers running into a hostage standoff. That should be trained SWAT team members. It's just like if a house is on fire. Mm-hmm. Would you let a parent, a person run back into a burning house? The firefighters don't do that.
No, I understand that too. But the firefighters go in. So here's the thing. Because it sounds like you say you want the police just to run in, that they want to go in there without a plan, without some kind of organization. The problem is you've got an immediate situation. You've got a dire emergency that requires the fastest possible action. You don't have time to sit around and then do a bunch of blueprints. You got to send at least, two pairs of officers in right away. And they may have to communicate outside, and they may have to, search their way through. But if you can save lives by getting officers in there faster, they have to go. So you can formulate the plan while you have officers in there. Especially if they can hear where the gunshots are, it's not hard to find. If somebody's run out of the building and says the assassin is in this area, they can converge on it. So it's the fact that they stood outside for over an hour and that they weren't allowing parents to go in, or they weren't allowing officers to go in. They didn't allow anybody to go in except those who did it, without permission, like the Border Patrol officer that went in and ultimately killed the assassin.
Well, if you go into a place where hostages are being held, what happens when you start killing the hostages?
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm not saying this is a good situation. But they were killing anyway. The assassin was already killing hostages. They're unknown.
Yeah, but they didn't have no way to know that, though.
Well, then if they walked into the building and they heard gunshots. Once you hear gunshots, that's pretty – that kind of changes everything.
When you walked in the building, he started killing hostages. If he had stayed outside, maybe he wouldn't.
But he didn't stay outside. Now, if he stayed outside with a gun, yeah, that's a whole different situation.
No, the police had stayed outside.
Well, see, I don't understand that.
They had a situation in Memphis similar to that. And the U.S. Marshals stayed outside. They didn't rush the house. They stayed outside and started negotiating. Because if they had went in or started approaching, he may have started shooting hostages. That's the whole point about taking hostages.
Well, so that's
you ever
different.
See that?
We think of school shooters as not, you know, as assassins. They're going in there to kill kids. They're not there to take hostages. How are they, you know, the whole idea of barricading themselves into a school classroom, considering how many people there are there? No. But I'll tell you another problem, though. When you've got one way in, you know, the assassin knows which way the police are going
to
come in because there's only one door into the building.
You need to have people that's trained and properly equipped to rush, you know, gunners like that. Look at Omaha Beach. Look at the American soldiers that was cut down by the Germans when they got out of the amphibious buildings. They was cut down like ducks in the water.
Well, those boats were kind of stupid. I mean, nothing against the Higgins boat and the other landing craft, the LC, whatever they're called. But those designs were terrible because they opened up, you know, and then the Germans opened up. I mean, you look at you know, Saving Private Ryan, the beginning of that film. That's apparently very realistic of what happened. So you've got the German machine guns, you know, firing directly into these landing craft. You know, I don't know how else they could have done it in World War II, by paratrooper or having a front that came in behind the lines or landed some obscure place.
That
I don't know how else to do it, you know, but, and we got D-Day coming up Monday, which is kind of
paratroopers coming down, they shoot them out the sky. But the thing is, you can expect normal, regular police officers, beat cops, to run in because now they killed. Now you got a family that's without a father. So the individuals that's used to handle that particular problem should be of a SWAT squad that's, you know, that's particularly trained in order to do that, and they sign up for it.
Then you need a SWAT officer in the school. Then, if the people are the most qualified to do this, you're going to have them as your school resource officer. They're going to have to be SWAT trained. So at least you have one person with SWAT training.
A school resource officer is designed to handle normal things in a school, fights, and you know stuff like that. They're not really designed. A resource officer is a guard with a gun on his side, and some don't even have that.
When I was in law enforcement, you know, my brief career in law enforcement as a customs inspector, we got training in clearing houses and, you know, search and seizure and arrest and all that kind of stuff. And that was pretty, you know, the house clearing stuff was one of the most interesting things we did. And then we had actual exercises. You know, I can't go into details because, you know, it's government training. But the point was, I was trained in that stuff. You know, I was trained in the, you know, the shoot, no shoot situation, to those scenarios. You know, it's pretty good.
Yeah. If you had five Kyle Rittenhouses in that school, normal cops ain't gonna go in there and come out alive.
What do you mean five
it's
Kyle
just
Rittenhouses?
Not gonna happen.
Kyle Rittenhouses.
Somebody
defending
was
himself.
Trained. Yeah, someone that was trained in the application of weaponry, the way he demonstrated when he came under attack. So normal police officers, you have to have someone who's particularly trained to address those situations, and those officers normally belong to the SWAT team.
Yeah. Are you sure you want to use Kyle Rittenhouse as an example? I mean, he's the one that was attacked by the, you know, during that Antifa Black Lives Matter protest, and he defended his life, you know, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you got a hostage, if you got a person held up in the school, you're going to be defending his life also.
Right.
Because the police is going to be trying to come in and take him out, so he's going to be spending his life. So you got a whole different individual. Now, you just got some run-of-the-mill person that never has pulled back to draw the slingshot. Well, that's a whole different thing. But you should have a SWAT team that's designed and trained for those type of particular situations. Not you have a whole bunch of dumb. It's like Rambo. Remember Rambo, the movie?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You don't see
Rambo
those films
took
anymore,
out a whole
except
lot
Top
of
Gun.
Cops.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Rambo took out Sylvester Stallone, and Rambo took out a whole bunch of cops.
Well, no, he didn't take them out. He destroyed, you know, buildings and property and things like that. And he didn't, you know, he actually wounded people. It's kind of a fascinating film, the first Rambo film. Anyway, looks like Shirley's online.
Well, I think that the way to solve that is several ways. Uh-huh. One, you need an armed citizen. Because if the men that he shot at coming out of the funeral home was able to shoot back, well, he may not have survived to go down to the school. Then you need to have teachers armed, like in many school districts in Texas, that have a sign out front. The sign out front warns those who want to do what he did that you're going to meet force for force if you come in here like that.
Yeah, so the problem with those things on houses, though, is that it encourages people to break in when nobody's there and steal the guns. That's the only problem with that. Let me just get the last part of this article that I want to get to Shirley here. And Shirley, because she's listening, this is the article by Miranda Devine in the New York Post, and it's called, let me just get my title again here real quick, Where Are Men of Courage? They're gone thanks to toxic masculinity. I'd be curious her opinion on this too. So it says here in the end, we used to venerate men like the entire shift of 15 firefighters from Midtown's Engine 54, Ladder 4, Battalion 9, whose fading photographs still face the heedless crowds on 8th Avenue. That's obviously 9/11. Men with families who live for, who rushed to their deaths on 9/11 because they believed in a system of honor and duty in which they were destined to be guardians of the community, men like Battalion Chief Edward, and then list the names and things like that. Then now their inheritors show up in emergencies and the public throws bottles and things at them. All right, let me skip that part. Let me get to the part that I wanted to. Oh, here we go. We pathologize many virtues and bow to the tyranny of identity politics that seeks power by overthrowing a make-believe patriarchy. We raise boys in the soup of reproach and negativity that tells them their intrinsic nature is diseased. Traditional masculinity is psychologically harmful, and that's from the American Psychological Association, declared this in 2019. These were the masculine attributes listed as diseased. Are you ready? Stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, aggression, anti-femininity, achievement, eschewal, I hate that word, of the appearance of weakness and adventure, risk and violence. The only acceptable man now is a man who wants to be a woman. We celebrate pregnant men and chest-feeding men. You see, in the drive to destroy masculinity, we've had to erase women as well. There's more to this, but I'm going to hold this now because I want to get to Shirley and get her opinion on this. So let me get Shirley's thing. Pianki, do you have a last word on that? And then we're going to be moving on here in a bit. Going once, going twice?
No, that is the final word.
Oh, I get the final word. I must be the host. When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She is the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall. So Shirley, what do you think of girly men? Now that we're on a theme. Good morning, Shirley. Where'd she go? I give this great intro, we play a theme, what happens? She's not there. Oh, you forgot to unmute? Yeah, I did that too.
I'm chatting away going, what?
See, this is what happens when you get so casual. You know, you get used to doing the show. Remember when you were, you're a little stressed out in the beginning, as everybody is when they start doing the radio stuff, and it's like, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? And then, of course, now it's like, I'll just chat until the theme comes on. It's kind of funny. Yeah, so that's how you know you're comfortable with all this. Yeah. Go ahead.
Are you hearing me okay? I'm trying my earbuds now. I haven't gotten my other stuff yet, but okay. Is this better than the speakerphone or not?
I don't know. It's fine. The speaker wasn't bad, actually. So that worked out. This works out, too. We got to get you a microphone, though, so that we can get you do real recording so that you can get a Yeti Blue.
I'm going back to the speaker then. Here we go.
Let's try it. Well, now we can compare.
How's that?
That's actually better.
What was my question? That's better? Okay.
You forgot your question? No. Girly men. You know, we've been talking about toxic masculinity has basically destroyed masculinity. And the guys that hung outside the school in Uvalde, waiting for an hour, is symptom of a girly man syndrome. Shirley, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we're getting plenty of them out here these days. It's so confusing. I can imagine a child growing up not knowing if they're a man or a woman. We're allowing them to make decisions. And then as they grow up, we don't, everybody's the winner, like nobody loses. You have to have a goal. You have to understand that there's standards that you have to keep. Everybody mm-hmm. doesn't get an award just for a participation award. There's winners and losers. And you need to understand that you got to work hard to be a winner. And you understand that there's rules you got to abide by. And I think that the rules, the fact that we have rules, is why a lot of young people are out there committing so many crimes. They're not brought up knowing there's consequences to their actions, not knowing that there's rules for a reason. And I can't imagine how confused some of these kids are. You look at some of the pictures and I just shake my head and go, what? And then you hear about schools letting boys in the girls' restroom. That's like, you've got to be kidding me. The boy?
No, apparently not. Apparently
I know, and now
they're talking that's a legal requirement. Yeah, for a title, something, I haven't really looked into it, but you know what I'm talking about. What's coming out of Brandon now? Schools have to
do this?
Exactly. They lose funding or something?
They're going to take away funding. Yeah, they're going to take away funding if they don't let men, the boys in the girls' restroom. That's just wrong. Totally wrong. That's crazy.
You know,
well,
I'll tell you what else is wrong. There's a tolerance for this. It's so, you know, the fact that this is even tolerated, not laughed out. It's like, what are you people insane? No way. And you know, they should be fired for even proposing something that stupid.
Exactly. And there are some parents that are speaking up. I read an article about, or no, actually I was speaking to someone. Mm-hmm. He said he's got grandkids. If a boy's ever gone into the girls' restroom with my granddaughter, he's going to have consequences to pay. You know, what needs to happen for more parents to stand up for that is just not right. There's
well, that's
something
a good point
wrong
too.
With that.
Are men standing up for our fathers standing up for their daughters? You know, my daughter called me, you know, big bad dad. You know, not that I said anything to her, but that she knew she was protected when she was with me. And we had a lot of adventures. We travel, you know, to Europe and Alaska and Hawaii and the Caribbean, and we were on windjammer sailboats. And she, you know, she didn't care because I was there. And that was my job as a dad. And, you know, I think that's part of the problem now. Now, how are the girly men going to be fathers, you know, to their sons or their daughters? That's my scary thought.
Yeah. And do they feel safe around there? Well, there's a lot of, I'm sure there's a lot of divorces and a lot of single.
I was divorced.
Parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm wondering also, because I know some women that raise their children, they're probably more protective than a lot of men are with their children now.
But there's different protection. Don't men and women protect differently? I mean, you know, the guys protect by raising guys to be protectors themselves. That's our job.
Right. And so how did we drop the ball on that? Where did that happen?
Well, let me ask you about feminism.
I didn't catch your whole article.
Oh, that's okay. No, well, we don't just pick up where we left off.
So
but let me ask you about feminism, you know, in terms of your understanding of feminism. You know, when I talk, there's like two phases. There's the phase that was necessary, the equality part. You know, women couldn't get credit cards, you know, unless their husband okayed it. Couldn't start businesses, couldn't do different things like that. And it goes all the way back to voting, when women couldn't vote. So equality feminism made perfect sense. It was absolutely essential. You know, it's legally binding under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. You can't discriminate against women. That's pure and simple. But somewhere along the line, feminism crossed the line from equality to privilege. You know, women scholarships, you know, women affirmative action, women contracts and grants and things like that. And now it is the demonization of men. I guess the third wave, they call it, you know, toxic masculinity. Men are bad. Men need to be controlled. Men need to be, boys need to be drugged in school. So as you understand feminism, you know, at what point did you think it went wrong? Or did, you know, well, tell me what you think. I'm just curious your experience. As a person younger than me, he said with a grin.
I'm not so sure about that, but okay.
About what? Oh, which part?
Me being younger than you, but that's okay.
I'm in my 60s, if that gives you any clue.
The
only reason I say
that,
though, I say that just to give perspective as to where our perspectives would be. So someone, you know, in their 60s would have seen feminism from before feminism and watched the whole development of it. Some in their 40s would have a different perspective. Some in their 20s would have a different perspective too, because they would have been exposed to the third wave, you know, all boys are toxic kind of thing growing up in school. So the reason, the only reason I give the age is simply because it puts a reference point in as to where you were at various times in history.
Okay, so basically our perspective is going to be about the same. Let me just put it that way.
Well, that's good.
But actually, you know, equality, if I can do a job just as good as a man, yes, I should get rewarded the same with my pay or whatever. But also I understand, you know, when you hear about these women that want to become SEALs and that kind of level where, you know, you just don't have the muscle and that is needed to do what they do. That's my barrier there. Because if it were me and good luck trying, but if it were me and I had to choose two different squads, one's all men and this one might have a couple of women in it, and they're coming to save me, I want all the muscle I can get, because that's what they do. That's what they have to have. They have to have, not to say that there aren't some really strong women out there, but there's a difference. There's a difference between men and women. And there's a difference in their body make and what they're capable of doing muscular-wise. Intelligent-wise, totally different. But, you know, there's limitations, and I think we have to understand that. And that's just the way we're built. So,
you know, it's interesting because the difference is between men and men. You know, most men could not pass the physical to be a SEAL. You know, it was like 0.1% of guys actually are strong enough to do it. But discriminated against all those men, 99.9% of men who could not become SEALs. No one cares about that. No, that's not even registering on people's brains. You know, they don't say, well, we can't have the, you know, the 5'1" guy, you know, who's, you know, the 98-pound weakling. Why can't he be a SEAL? I mean, it's not fair. It's not equitable. It's not equal. You know, so in other words, to single women out and say that we have to have a certain percentage of women on this, you know, SEAL squad is irrational. That's the problem. It's like it's the privilege, saying that women have to be there as representative of the population. But SEALs aren't representative of the population. They're the top, you know, 0.1% of the most elite, of the best of the military. That's how you get to be there. And then discriminate against everybody. So men or women, doesn't matter. It's just, can you meet the qualifications or not?
Exactly. And there are some situations where that's the case, and that has to be respected. It's not just because of what sex you are, what color your skin is. It's just, can you meet the qualifications for the job?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
And I think society's getting to the point where they're just so concerned about hurting someone's feelings. Well, you know, just cowboy up.
Cowboy up. I like that. Yeah, this is pretty cool. Yeah, talk show host up. Yeah, there you go. I go back to flight instruction a lot, and Panky's on the line too, so feel free to jump in. When I was teaching flying, I had a very high number of women students, you know, from a high school kid all the way up to older folks, and one of my favorites was a combat trauma nurse. I don't know if she had a medal or not, but she certainly deserved one. This is the bravest person I've ever flown with. Man or woman didn't matter. And as a flight instructor, I think I had a lot of women students because I didn't discriminate. I didn't treat women differently. Everybody got abused in my airplane. I was a tyrant. But it was a good time. I was a benevolent dictator. But, you know, you had to work, you know, and if you want to be a good pilot, I took people into, you know, short runways and around trees and bad weather and crosswinds and everything else. I didn't care. Men and women, if you want to learn to fly, I'm going to teach you how to fly, you know, and so you can either do it or you can't. I wasn't mean or anything like that, but I'm just saying my standards were very high because they were high for myself. And I never asked anybody to do anything that I either wouldn't or couldn't do myself. And everybody knew that. So I had a great time. But I think because of that attitude, I got a lot of women students, you know, and a couple of some of my best students. In fact, it's interesting. The people that requested spin training were two of my women students requested it. So I want to learn spin training. You got to put me through it. And there's only so much you can do with a student. You kind of go spin entries unless you want to endorse them for instructor training or throw in a couple of parachutes. But they insisted. So the women that came to learn to fly with me were some of the top students. The fact they're women was just part of it, but that they were top students and they wanted to learn more. And it's quite fascinating. So it really comes down to character and individuality. But I think overall in society, we've got a man problem. Now, it's interesting, the group that you're in, you're with a group of very special women who are competitive shooters and very independent. I would say a group compared to, you know, the women that, you know, want to be trophy wives and, you know, sit around and do whatever it is, you know, marry rich and things like that. You're a totally different group of women and a very special group. And do you see that as different than other women, or just by circumstance you find yourself where you are?
I think we represent a lot of women out there that are just like us. We do have that care and concern for, you know, that the nurturing nature that's in women. And that's kind of what I was going to, when I caught you talking about, you know, 100 men, 100 women, who's rushing into the fire, or, you know, you talked about that part. And as far as confronting people, there's that little bit of nurturing that not everybody is built or wants to. We don't want to harm somebody, but yet if we need to defend ourselves or our families, there's that mama bear that comes out. So there's two different sides to women. They're more nurturing, but yet watch out for the mama bear when she comes out. And the women that are represented in DC Project are all different types, different from different levels of financially, different levels, sisters, aunts, mothers. You know, we're all different, in where we are in life. But our one goal is that we want to be able to protect our families, our loved ones, and other people. And we do that by protecting the Second Amendment. But I think there's more women out there, because just look at all the women out there buying firearms for the first time. They realize that they are their own first responder. They can't just wait for a police officer to come barging in and save their lives all the time. Most of the time, they're coming in the cleanup portion of it. And I have police friends that tell me that same thing. You know, it's very seldom that they're going to get there while the crime is being committed. It's usually after it's said and done. So
yeah, that's why protection is universal. And this is why it's so good. We've talked about this before, where we need, you know, women, you know, owning guns for protection, for family, for voting, you know, for the cause, for you know, helping everybody's freedom. And so this is a critical component. It's interesting that protection is universal. I believe I may come at it from different perspectives slightly, being men and women, but the protection aspect, I think, is definitely there in those that are protective. Those that aren't protective, that's a different story. Pianchi, did you have a comment?
Yeah, nowhere in the sign-up qualifications for a police officer does it make mention that they will be expected to charge a hold-up situation. I know in St. Louis, I've seen police officers, or there's been occasions when police officers have been ambushed going down alleys.
Yeah.
And the perpetrators in the alleys kill them. So what do you do with that? You had another individual, Ralph Brown. He had two servers come to serve him with papers, and he opened the door and shot both of them. So I think that you have to have officers, personnel that's specially trained and equipped for those type of situations. And maybe
but we expect police to respond, though. Yeah, no, I know, but the problem is, let me tell you, I was going to talk to this, and then we get to what Shirley wants to talk about, which I tend to walk over all the time in our little workshop here. Something happened to me just the other day. I was going to a local popular shopping center, supermarket, and just as I'm about to get in my car, in the process of getting in my car, the state trooper races into the parking lot, parks really fast, kind of badly, you know, hops out of his car and walks very briskly into the supermarket. My first instinct was, first of all, I want to go too. You know, I'm armed, all right. I'm carrying my Glock, right. I'm thinking I can help. There was no hesitation on my part. I mean, it was just instantaneous. I thought, but I want to get too close. I want to scare him to think that I'm, you know, part of the problem, whatever the problem is in there. But my initial instinct was to walk in right behind him. I'm looking around. As I'm walking, I'm thinking, okay, cover, analyze the situation. What's going on? Where am I going to be? How do I identify myself? If there is an active shooter in there, what do I do? So I've already mentally, and I didn't think about this for a second. It just happened. It was instinctive. You know, but I find that fascinating that was my reaction. I looked at it later and went, oh, that's kind of interesting. That my initial reaction was to walk in, knowing that there might be a life and death situation there. And I still wanted to walk in and help. Now, I'm not doing this just to pat myself on the back and blow my own horn here. But what I want to say is that I believe that this is instinctive. And whether it's with men or women, you know, depending on the situation, I don't think that really matters. I think there are just those of us out there. You know, I think Shirley and Pianchi probably do exactly the same thing. that given that situation, a trooper walks in, you know, briskly, you know, into a market. Turns out he was getting his lunch or something like that. It was just kind of funny. But my thought was, this could be a problem given the fact that murders happened in a supermarket up in Buffalo, you know, in the very recent history. But let me ask you both the same question. Do you think that instinctively some people don't care? I mean, I had no thought for my personal safety. Didn't care. Didn't even occur to me. I want to help. You know, and I think I would have been a good cop, but I had more problems with the other police than I had with the actual job, because I could certainly do the job. But the type of people that became government law enforcement, they didn't care for me too much. You know, Shirley, what do you think? What do you think you'd be doing in that situation?
I think there are people that are wired to be true warriors, and those are the people that go into the military, they join the police force. They're just wired that way. They're wired to protect, and that's what they do. And that's the elite and the SEALs and the Delta Force and those types of high end of that. But, yes, there are people that are wired to do that. And I'm wondering, as we're talking about that, because I expect police officers, just like firemen, you chose a job where you're going to put your life on the line because that's who you are. And I'm wondering, are they, number one, are they now, because of the way they're treating police officers when they are confronted with someone or when they have to shoot someone to protect themselves or someone else, and then how they're prosecuted, because of that change, or are they told by their superiors not to engage now because of stuff like that, because of lawsuits? Because,
that's a good question.
You know.
Yeah.
So is our society making our police officers less likely to charge the building because of what their senior officers are telling them, because of the fear of being prosecuted or whatever's happening these days? Because it's so easy now. Everybody turns on a police officer when he defends himself. It's just a different nature. And like I've done before, a lot of police officers I know of have 25, 30 years, and I say, if you were starting in now, would you still become a police officer? And they're like, no. Because, you know, they don't get respect. When I grew up, you respected that officer. You respected him. You did what you were told. When you saw him, you just keep your act together. But now it's like they just run up and, you know, ambush him, hurt them. They have no fear of consequence, and they need that. We need to put that back there, I think.
Well, Greg, if you had ran in there and got hurt, you on your own, right?
No, I know.
Police would get hurt.
My thought was helping a police officer. Yeah, my thought was actually helping the trooper because he was the only one there. So it was just kind of interesting anyway. Is an attitude thing. Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah. Another thing, if you go in there and shoot one of the criminals, then you can be subjected to lawsuits.
You don't
have any qualified immunity in most cases. Now, here's another point, too. They had a case in California where you had two shooters that had heavily body protection on them. And I think they even went in a bank or something. And the police came and shot them, and the bullets bounced off of them because of what they was wearing.
Yeah, I remember that.
And
case.
I think that they shot
Los
back
Angeles.
And killed some people. You had a case here in Louisiana where you had a man came out of Kansas City of Missouri, came here and ambushed two police officers, killing one and seriously injuring the other. And they ran up on him. So it just depends. You may find a criminal that is very astute in that type of situation, and he may take out quite a few police officers that's not necessarily trained and what they should be in order to meet that type of force.
No, that makes sense. You know, and like I say, I knew I was on my own. And like my other thought was protecting the trooper, because, you know, there are cases where people have killed assassins that are about to kill police, you know, sometimes with their own gun. And the only reason the police survived is that, an armed citizen, you know, took care of the problem. And so these are the thoughts I'm thinking too, because it's the only one guy here. You know what's going on. But then, of course, you think later in retrospect, well, where were the, you know, we have Milton police, we have, you know, the county sheriffs and things like that, if there really was a problem. But it just, like I say, it was an interesting attitude analysis. of what my thinking was at the time. My first thought was just instinctively go in carefully. I mean, I didn't run into the place. I'm carefully looking around. Okay, what's going on? Is anything happening? And I walked in, quickly realized nothing was happening. You know, so okay, we're done. It's over. But it's just, I just found that attitude quite interesting. That I had no thought of risk or, you know, what? Go ahead.
So what would that happen? The criminal took your gun from you and pointed it at you. There have been cases where criminals have taken police officers' guns.
Yeah.
And they're wrestling around on the ground. I remember in Illinois where a highway patrolman, a female, pulled a guy over, and he overpowered her, handcuffed her to her car, and with her back to traffic, and he pulled her pants down. This is a real life thing that happens.
That's humiliation. Yeah, that's, Oh, yeah, stuff happens like that. You know, we trained for gun retention in the federal law enforcement. And, you know, I went to the FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. So we trained for stuff like that. And, of course, in reality, you don't really know, you know, what exactly is going to happen. Nobody does. And I would not be revealing the fact that I was a concealed carry holder, you know, unless there was an emergency requiring the use of a firearm, you know, just, you know. And that's part of the deal, too. So nobody would know until, you know, and of course my other thought was, you know, I have to make sure that I'm identified as me, the good guy, you know, as one of the good guys, not one of the bad guys. So you really have to think of a lot of things when you go into a situation like that. And then, of course, you have to think, too, that it's probably nothing, which is good. That's the way it turned out. It was nothing, you know. And so, but it's just interesting how various minds work, and that's why I was curious. Well, yeah, Shirley, if you were in that same situation, you know, you see a police officer walking briskly into a building. It's a shopping center. Given that the fact that there was just a murder, several murders at a shopping center recently, what would be your initial thoughts?
Wow, that's quite a question. I really don't know.
Don't think.
I
just,
really,
you've just seen
really,
it. Go for it.
I really don't know how I'd react. Played it in my mind if someone were to become an active shooter. You know, how would I engage? And I don't think I would know until I was faced with that situation. It's kind of like, you know, the domestic violence situation I was in. I didn't know what I was capable of, even though I wasn't educated on any type of self-defense, until that time came. But I would hope that with my training and everything would kick in and I would do the right thing to save lives. But I don't. It's not a requirement. Sometimes it's funny how some students come to my classes and they get this feeling that they have to, if they have a firearm, they have to do something. It's like the Good Samaritan Act. You know, you don't have to. If you feel you don't feel comfortable engaging in a dangerous situation, there's nothing wrong with retreating. There's nothing wrong with organizing people to get away. Just because you have a concealed carry license does not require you to become a police officer, you know, that respond to things. And I think I would.
You know, another thing too, the dangers in that, is that if you come to be a good Samaritan to assist a police officer that's been knocked down in it, and you hold a gun on the criminal, then when the other police come and you hold a gun on the criminal, they're going to shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
That has happened before.
I thought of that too. Yeah, that's part of the scenario.
Yeah. And that's part of the training you get. And I'm sure, Greg, you've had that training. You have to have your head on a swivel if you're holding a firearm. When as soon as you see police officers, you follow their orders and you put that gun down.
Absolutely.
Their adrenaline's pumping just as much as yours is. So it's very important that you have that visual, because your hearing's not going to be as acute and you might not hear their commands, but you'll see them coming. You know what's really hard, because you can what-if situations to death, but you don't know until you're actually put in that situation how you're going to respond. But you have a better idea, because that you are ready to do that, understanding that, you know, you're putting your life in the danger, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But you've already had all this training, so it seems like it's more automatic, and you have that warrior mentality inside you. So
yeah, I'm such a nerd, though. You look at me, you wouldn't think of me.
Well,
like
you can be a warrior nerd.
I'm a warrior nerd. Yeah, I'm definitely a warrior nerd. Yeah. Well, you know what really helped though was flight instruction, because we did have, and I purposely put there were two instructors, me and this other guy named Stan. And Stan and I were kind of we were sort of frowned upon by another instructor who only took his students up in nice weather. He says, I'm not going to take them in bad weather. They're not supposed to fly in that. Well, I'm thinking, what if they get in by accident? And I've had students do that. One student come back and congratulate me. He got caught in some really bad crosswinds, and there was nowhere else to go. The fuel in the airplane did not allow him to go to a place where the winds were much lighter. And because I'd taken him up in horrendous crosswinds, he did a fine landing. I had another student where he was on takeoff with his girlfriend, and the seat broke, and he was sent to the back of the airplane. He could not reach the controls, you know. So and on takeoff, he's like 400 or 500 feet up. And but had the president's mind, he tells me, you know, I thought, what would Greg tell me to do? You know, because I always say, well, what do you do if? You know, what if? What if this happens? I've always given my students scenarios. And so he immediately unbuckles his belt, crawls up on his knees, and flies the airplane on his knees. That's pretty inventive. Okay. So, but that's how I train my students. You know, and so I've been through emergencies. I've lost an engine. I lost an engine once during a lesson. We got it restarted again, but we almost, you know, made the news. I've had other problems. I was teaching in a twin one day, and we actually shut off the engine. We did that once because it's not really good for the engine to shut off an engine in flight because it cools too rapidly. But we did it one time per student, and so we had the engine off. You know, and we're operating on one engine, and then this air pulls out of a spin right in front of us. You know, and instinctively I like dive the airplane down on, you know, as they pull the power back on the good engine so we didn't unbalance, dove that thing down and got away from, and thinking, God, nobody's below us right now, you know. But you just, the thing I learned from flight instruction is that reaction is that, you know, I'm pilot in command. And I think pilot in command translates very easily to person in command of yourself in those situations, having been in real emergencies, you know, and potential emergencies, because we push the envelope, as they say, to make better pilots. I was kind of used to that. So I'm kind of a little bit of an adrenaline junkie at times, you know, because I like the challenge of being in this situation. And I like being able to do things that very few people can do, even though I'm a warrior nerd. I think it's a great term. But, you know, it's kind of all part of it.
Yeah. And everything that we're talking about actually plays into my Teal for Two-Way story that I posted this past Tuesday.
I want to touch base
on that, because, you know, you don't get a whole lot of coverage on media, and it has to do with a woman. Armed woman stops the West Virginia mass shooting.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Charleston, West Virginia. And I love that this statement. Police say a woman's actions may have prevented a mass casualty event following an altercation between a man speeding through a neighborhood. May have prevented. I'm pretty sure she did prevent it.
May have prevented. Guy comes out with a rifle, aiming at the crowd, and she may have prevented. That's pretty because they can't say that she did, because if they say that she did, that means that the guns can do good things, and that's the narrative they can't have. That's why that may came from. Very perceptive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
very perceptive. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and then
that's the way the news and media and their demonic way of writing things up. Because I've seen another article, and they called her an off-duty police officer. So what they're doing is saying she had a right to have a gun.
No, that's saying only the government can save you. You can't save yourself, or citizens can't do it. It has to be government. Only government can save you. That's what I think the message is.
So the Charleston Police Department, this lieutenant, he said she did the right thing. I don't know if any other person would have done that. Just like we're talking about, that warrior mentality. Do you have it? Well, you know, how you don't know until you're in that situation. And I'm not even going to give that person's name that was going to commit the crime, the criminal. No. He was speeding up and down the parking lot inside this apartment complex. And he was approached by people attending the graduation and a birthday party who asked him to slow down as kids were playing in the area. And that's how it all started. And, let me see. Oh, come on. Now my computer's going to freeze up. No. Okay.
It happens. You're on radio.
Said that this criminal was agitated and he left but returned to the complex shortly after, armed with an AR-15 style rifle, and started shooting at the crowd. Police said a woman pulled out her pistol, shooting and killing him. The lady was carrying a lawful firearm.
Wait a minute. Stop right there. They always say that. You know, this is another thing that always happens in these stories. They have to make sure that the gun was legally carried. So in other words, if someone saved the lives of a bunch of people with a gun that was unregistered or unapproved or didn't have a current concealed carry permit, then she'd be a criminal too.
Right. And then we're gonna press that a little more in the article, because a law abiding citizen, once again, who stopped the threat of probably 20 or 30 people getting killed. She engaged the threat and stopped that. She didn't run from the threat. She engaged it, preventing a mass casualty event here in Charleston. That's from the law enforcement officer. And this guy she killed, this criminal, he had an extensive criminal history. In 2016, he was accused of shooting and pistol whipping a 19-year-old woman, but those charges were dismissed because no witnesses testified at a pretrial hearing.
That's interesting.
Court records. Isn't that? I was like, what? Just because there's no witnesses? That was like, yeah. I went, more information.
I mean, there wasn't evidence of the victim, the bruises and things. I mean, that didn't count. I mean, people lie sometimes about things like that, but I don't know. You get a preponderance of evidence. It's called circumstantial. Anyway, Pianki, go ahead.
Well, we know we talk about different jurisdictions, different states, but you have situations which are similar. Now, in this particular case, you wonder what the prosecutor is going to do, because she had the same type of situation of self-defense, basically, but not like this, in Florida, in Orange County, where the lady killed the intruder who came in her house. And the chief said she was in her right to do so. But you got a prosecutor who said that they're going to review the case and see if there's any charges should be leveled on the homeowner.
Yeah, I mean, they do that all the time. You know, it's all about controlling. And here's another term you might like, Greg. Politically sanctioned violence.
What? You perk my ears up there. What do you mean politically sanctioned violence?
I know. You'd love that one.
I know what that is. That's where conservatives, you know, gun-owning conservatives are responsible for mass murders. We encourage it through the NRA. The Second Amendment really is a license to mass murder. That's what they're saying, right? How am I doing? Did I get it?
Yeah, you got it. It's the same as the criminals or
emboldened.
The group. Yeah.
The word emboldened, like Donald Trump emboldened white supremacists around the country.
Is there a white supremacist angle to this too?
To the story? No. No.
Oh, okay.
No. I mean, the basic point of this guy had a criminal record.
Mm-hmm.
He had two other felonies in the past, so he legally should not have been had in possession any firearms. So he broke a number of laws.
Oh, my goodness. Gun control didn't work? I'm shocked. I'm shocked, Shirley. I'm just absolutely
shocked.
There
you go.
Oh, what happened?
Bingo.
Well, here's the thing, too. He actually started shooting. He was actually shooting in the parking lot. He wasn't brandishing a gun. He didn't walk out of his vehicle with a gun. He actually started shooting before this woman engaged with him.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, that's what he says. He started shooting.
So if he started shooting, there's no doubt in your mind what the intentions are. You know, if she pulled a gun on him while he walked out with his gun and said, "What the hell are you doing?" You know, and then if you leveled at her, then she's fully entitled to shoot. But the fact that he was already shooting when she engaged with him, and that's a pretty open and shut case as far as I'm concerned. Now, did they mention the race of the participants, either the criminal or the hero here? I'm just curious because that always plays a part. The race.
What did
because
you ask?
The race? In Buffalo,
no.
they didn't mention. Okay, that's interesting. All right.
No, you know
no,
why?
No, but they have a picture of him. There's a picture in this one article.
All right.
Yeah. He
I'm
was
asking
like
Pianki's
30,
question.
What's his skin color?
37 years old. Huh?
What's his skin color?
He's a 37-year-old black man.
Absolutely. Now, here's the thing. And the woman was probably black, too. But I'm saying, but if she was a white male, then the news would have wrote it up as vigilante justice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. If it was a white male that shot this black man who was shooting at a crowd of people, then it would have been written up as the white male that shot him, or maybe a white female also, in this case it was a female, as being a vigilante taking the law into her own hands.
And how did they know the criminal's intentions? How did they know that he was actually going to shoot people even though he was shooting? How did they know for sure? Yeah, I bet you that was going to be the angle, too. That's interesting. So do you know the race of the
purpose.
Exactly. Do you know the race of the woman?
The purpose is to put it into the reader's mind.
Right.
The purpose is to put it into the reader's mind, not get into the intention of the criminal.
Exactly. Yeah. Now I'm going to let that's going to take me into my next segment.
Ooh. And we got extra time for you, so feel free. We got till the bottom of the hour, so if you got the time, we've got the time.
Yeah.
Good.
Just like the media. The media is directing the thoughts of those people that don't do research or don't think don't think logically. Just like I was at the NRA annual meeting in Houston, where on Friday they had 1,000 to 2,000 protesters.
What exactly were they protesting? I'm curious. What was their message?
Oh, that we are killers. NRA is a killer. NRA killed all these kids. We killed all these kids. Anyone attending is a killer. We were called names. I can't repeat. I've never.
Yeah, believe it. What was the bigger message?
At one point, I went out the conference at the convention center. It's across the street, and kudos to Houston Police Department, the Border Patrol, the Mounted Police. They were always there. They were
the
always
Border
there.
Patrol?
A number of them. SWAT.
The Border
team,
Patrol.
Everybody was there. Yep. Huh, they had.
Where's
they
the
had
border?
Everybody.
Sorry,
they had everybody. There was. There. They had everybody there. They probably called them in, I guess.
Oh, okay.
But they had
yeah.
Border Patrol uniforms on.
That's federal,
they,
though.
I didn't see that there were one to 2,000 actual people there. There was a perspective that some people got from their hotel room when they're like nine stories up. But I went outside the convention center because right in the entryway, they were on the other side of the street hollering at anybody coming in. And I looked at this guy standing beside me, and I went, wow, so much for education. The most I could get out is four-letter words. I mean, screaming and hollering. I'm gonna not just say holding up your signs peacefully, but screaming and hollering. And so DC Project, we felt we needed to have our presence known and what we believed in.
Mm-hmm.
So on Saturday morning, we did our own rally. The sheriff's office, the police department said, okay, you can stay on this side. This is pro, this is anti. There's like a division in the park across from the convention center. So I'd say there was about 30 of us that went out there with our signs. And on Saturday, they didn't have as many protesters at the 11:30 when we went out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went out there with our signs, and we were out there for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes.
Getting
you know,
coverage.
There's another side to the story.
Yeah.
No.
Any news coverage? I'm shocked.
No, that's what we were hoping for, but no. And the one of the guys that was doing some video, we had someone video. We had Turning Point USA. We just happened to have their photographer just happened to be there, so he's videoing and doing stuff like that. The news press for anyone that got into the NRA that was called press, there's like quite a few of them across taking pictures, but no television, like news media, didn't come down there. And one of the guys said, if you guys start chanting, you will probably get some news media. And we're like, we're already outside our comfort zone. You know, we're concerned about safety because, you know, when you have thousands of people and you have 30 women standing there, but yeah, you had the police there. I mean, they took care of us. They really did. Let's put it this way. I felt safe enough because they knew what we were doing. We told them what we were doing and they were ready.
Well, that's a
they
big
had
part
mounted
of it too.
Patrol.
Yeah,
they had mounted people there, and I think they might even had some undercover behind us too.
Yeah.
So
whenever
I can't tell you, but I'm pretty sure there was a lot of women in the group that were probably carrying. Just telling you. Probably.
So the convention had no problem with people carrying in the convention, right? There were no signs, you know, welcome to the NRA convention, please leave your guns at home. You know, they didn't care.
Right. The only place you can do that if you were in the ILA meeting with President Trump and
Lieutenant
Governor Mark Robinson. They had some really good speakers. But yeah, there was no signs about that. And so we're getting condemned because they feel that we did something wrong and that we're the reason why these children got murdered. We know that's not
true.
Let's
expand on that, because that's something I think is really interesting. What do you think the message is? What do you think these people believe? What were they really trying to tell the world? Because I've got an idea.
Oh,
I'll get
you angry.
First, though.
They're trying. What I saw is just so much anger directed at anything they could. I don't think they even had to understand what was going on. They were just angry people, and I think they were just taking it out. They had an avenue here. Oh, gun control. Yeah, that's a good one. We can take the guns away, and then all of a sudden we'll be safer. Logically, that's not how it works. Criminals aren't going to obey laws. They've already broken. Look how many laws that murderer, that assassin, broke. He shot at his grandmother. He shot his, let's repeat
that.
Somebody
can shoot their grandmother. You think laws are going to stop someone that can shoot their grandmother?
Exactly.
No. Yeah. But here's the thing, though. What they're really doing, here's the message I had, was that they're trying to equate gun owners, law-abiding gun owners, with criminals, saying they're the same thing. It's like saying that illegal aliens are immigrants or non-citizens. You know, it's this false equivalency that goes on all the time. So if you want to pick a theme, if you want to sort of work on something in the DC project that would be really critical, it's something that I do or try to do all the time. Say there is a wall of separation between constitutional rights and the actions of criminals. They have absolutely nothing to do with each other. You can't directly do something to one and have it affect the other. You know, if you lock up criminals, that's not going to affect our constitutional rights, because our rights are our rights. You know, if you take away our rights, that's not going to do anything to criminals. They're completely different arguments. So, but this is the great false equivalency, that gun owners are in fact criminals, that guns are in fact dangerous in the hands of everybody, not just criminals, but everybody. And that's the message. I think that's the underlying message of everything that these people are protesting. That's what drives them. That's what drives the anti-gun groups. You know, they are really anti-rights groups. You know, they're for whatever their racism, sexism, and everything else that they exhibit, it really comes down to they believe that guns themselves are bad and that the people who have them are murderers. They just haven't done it yet.
You know that gun control doesn't affect them. I'm saying most cases, they probably never even touched a firearm. So if it doesn't affect me, I can jump on that bandwagon and I can holler and scream and feel like I'm making a difference. But
no,
logically,
true.
There's no logic to it. It's just like more people are killed in an automobile. Why aren't you out protesting against automobiles? Because everybody has one, because it would affect their life. They don't want to affect their life. No, they don't. That if it affects their life, then no, they don't want to do it. It's crazy. And then that, I'm going to roll that into probably something that Jim would probably have been covering. I'm going to cover that. We got a few minutes rather quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Go
ahead.
Is the bills that are in Congress now, the H.R. 7910, Protecting Our Kids Act. this whole thing that they're putting together does not protect your kids. It does not do anything to secure our schools. It does not do anything to correct the problems that we've experienced at schools. It doesn't do anything except add more gun control to people that do not need gun control. We need to protect our schools like we protect our politicians, and they're not doing that. This act has nothing to do with protecting kids. None of the things that they have, safe storage, raising the age to 21 to purchase a firearm, limiting high capacity mags to 10 rounds. And none of the things they're doing here would have stopped any mass killing but they're calling it a kid's act.
Go ahead, Bianca, and then I want to make a point on this because it's kind of critical. Go ahead, Bianca.
Anyway, that's beyond the jurisdiction of the federal government. But my question is, at this convention that they had, did they have any black NRA members there? I'm a lifetime member, but I'm just wondering, when you was walking about it, this vicious crowd, did they have any blacks that were,
Definitely. We even had Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. He's black. We've had a lot of the members were black. Yeah. Yeah. They were coming in and out that door.
Okay,
and even they were bused to different hotels. And one of my friends was waiting on the bus and she goes, "Oh my gosh, we were harassed so bad. It's crazy."
Yeah. I was just wondering how that played out when you got in the greater part of the demonstrators was white, right?
On their side, yes, yes.
Yeah, and I wonder why come it didn't play out that these demonstrators were portraying racism against the blacks, calling them murderers, and trying to prevent them from having access where they can protect themselves.
That's because they're liberal white supremacists. That's why. You can use that. Yeah, but... That was the point I was going to make earlier. I totally forgot what it was now. These bills, they always have bills and they have these horrendous titles like the Affordable Care Act or the Patriot Act or anything that part of Congress. This is why when we do bills here at Action Radio, our titles are accurate. You know, and there's a reason for that. So that people actually know what we're talking about. This is amazing that the protests and the folks that are there that are trying to disarm everybody. And the bill, we need a new name for it. You know, you call it the Childhood Victimization Act or the Parental Disarmament Act or something horrendous like that. Put a new name on it because this is how you fight these things. You've got to come up with better names.
That just shows you what they name the bill is not what's in it. And if you
have gun control bill.
Legislators that aren't actually reading the bill, and if you see this, as a layperson, if I see this Protecting Our Kids Act, and then, okay, that didn't pass, I'm like, oh my gosh, why didn't that pass? That's going to protect my kids in school. It doesn't. And that's the false narrative because most people are not going to, because, you know how bills are written. They're not going to read
stuff
inside. They're just going to get,
the
media is just going to show you the headline because then all of a sudden, the people that want to protect their kids are wondering why that Republican is voting against that. Doesn't he want to protect my kids? It's just
exactly.
That
oh, that's
false.
Why they do it. Oh, no, it's psychological warfare. But you got to fight back with other psychological warfare, too. But the one thing that that is missing, I think, that's something that's really critical, there's been a change in the debate. They've expanded the definition of what they call assault weapons to include any handgun, any semi-automatic handgun, especially the 9mm, the most common, you know, round in the country right now. You know, it's kind of like a 38 for semi-autos. But if you notice Brandon and everybody else, they're talking about this. So what they're really going after now, the quote, the new assault weapons ban, which is blatantly unconstitutional. Oh, I know the point I was going to make. All right. But let's talk about this one first. Have you noticed the change in the debate that an assault weapon, a weapon of war, is now anything semi-auto?
And also, a 9mm will blow out your lungs.
No, that was – I couldn't believe that. Really, just physically take a lung out of your body. That's quite fascinating. But that's a huge change. And here's the other thing, too. This is anti-woman because a lot of women shoot 9mm because it's not like a 357 Magnum. You know, I don't even like 357 Magnums unless I got a 6-inch barrel revolver and I'm at a range outside because they're ridiculously loud. But the point is that a 9mm, this is why the Army, I think, went to 9mm over the 45, because it's the round that anybody can shoot. You know, it's a low recoiling round. It does what it's supposed to do. It defends you, and it's controllable. And I think that, how popular is 9mm amongst the D.C. Project folks?
Oh, it's a very popular firearm, caliber firearm.
Yeah.
And across a lot of students, a lot of my students as well. To anyone that's working out there, because I'm going to want to step on, who's coming on next?
Derek Park, but he's not till 7:30, so we got a little bit of time. Oh, bottom of the hour.
Okay.
Yep.
Just as we're talking about this bill, this is the time when you need to contact your representative. Email them, make a phone call, let them know that this is not the answer, and to vote no to the H.R. 7910. We need to let our politicians know how we feel. This is how we make a difference. We talked about that with Lauren, and she spoke in front of a congressional committee. But this is, you don't have to speak in front of a congressional committee. Your voice does make a difference. We've talked about that. One voice, not just one voice. It's multiple voices. It starts with one voice. And I thought this was pretty funny. One of the Florida congressmen I don't know if you how to pronounce his name. Stubbe,
S-T-E-B-E. Greg Stubbe, yeah. I know who he is, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was doing a video conference for the House Judiciary Committee meeting on this. Did you see that?
Yeah,
and he pulled out
yeah.
multiple firearms, multiple
yep.
guns, handguns.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the comments, I was scrolling through, and one of the comments, a Democrat, I don't know who she was, where she was
Sheila
from.
Sheila Jackson Lee. Sheila Jackson Lee.
Is that
Lee.
The one that said, I hope they're on... unloaded.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I you know, I'm sure that they were, but my first thought was, does she think she can get hurt on a video conference with a loaded firearm?
No, actually you can, but I mean, he was in his home. So, and do you remember what his response
right.
was?
But, I mean, she couldn't get hurt.
That's no, right. she was thinking she was going to get hurt. That woman is idiot. Is an idiot.
Yeah. Well, that was funny. And Stubbe, do you remember what Stubbe said? Do you want to give the punchline here?
No, go ahead.
Okay. He said, I'm in my own home. I can do whatever I want with my guns. And so
I do remember that.
That was a classic, yeah. But here's just before you go, I really want to make this point too, because I'm hoping to encourage you and everybody else in every group to start thinking not only of voting, you know, telling people to vote no on this, but replacing it with something better. Okay. We've got, I think, four bills that would be critical at this time for DC Project to say, vote no on this, but let's make gun ownership a civil right. Let's have hearing protection so you don't lose your hearing if you have to defend your life. Let's change the background check so that the prohibited list is on the computers and there's no record of you if you're an honest law-abiding citizen. There's like four of them. There's like another one I have here. The Exercise and Enjoyment Act, which would give tax credits and tax deductions and vouchers maybe, you know, for people, especially of low income, so they're not blocked from their civil rights, for their constitutional rights. So you need to replace. This is the whole point of the show, is to say, okay, this law is bad. We know that. But you've got to offer something in its place. Otherwise, you're missing an opportunity, I believe. And if you can take this, you know, and I say highly, highly encouraged here, because that's kind of what the show's about, to go to DC Project and say, well, if we're going to complain against this, let's offer solutions. Let's say, okay, well, you know, you can't ban these things because this is our constitutional right. But we have a bill here that actually makes it easier for you to exercise your constitutional right because we're going to offer tax credits, you know, for especially for low-income folks so they can have access to quality firearms and ammunition. That's what I'm hoping to do. So always think about the solution, not just the problem. And I think conservatives
exactly.
and gun owners are too used to thinking of the problem, and they stop there. And it's like, no, don't stop. You know, we've got solutions.
Because anytime there's a problem, you want to have a solution. Those are all good points. And just like in this bill, there's going to be a bill that actually does secure our schools and helps them out. But you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. We need to promote the solution because, well, once again, lots of times certain people do not want to hear the solution because what? It doesn't go to their agenda, which is
right.
taking away our freedom and our ability to defend ourselves. Good point. Good point you make.
Oh, good. I was just going to say the best way to take somebody off their agenda. Hold on a second. The best way to take these folks off their agenda is to put them on the defensive. If you say, this bill is stupid, this is crazy, but we'd like to have tax credits so that low-income people and minorities can exercise their rights, you know, you put them on the defensive because now they're going to be end up arguing against a bill that promotes civil rights and is for racial equality. That's where you want to put them. I mean, it's a rhetorical trick, but, I mean, they do it all the time. I just want to be able to do it better. Shirley, and then we'll go to Pianki. What do you think?
Yep, I agree totally. That's a good point. So, when I was in management, my boss always said, don't come to me with a problem until you have a solution. Okay, so-and-so screwed up, but here's how we're going to keep that from happening again. Same
mm-hmm.
thing here.
Yeah.
That bill's not going to work, so here, this is what will help actually make a difference.
Yep.
But if it doesn't follow their politically sanctioned violence agenda, they probably will say no to that.
Doesn't matter. You know, and this is the thing, too. You don't have to pass these bills to have them have effect. The fact that you proposed
right.
if you guys had a big press conference and say, we are for making gun ownership a civil right. We are for changing the background check so we don't record the law about anything. We are for tax credits for low-income people so they can purchase firearms and have the same access that the rich people do. You will change the debate in this country overnight away from that bill.
Got her thinking.
Pianki?
The thing with Sheila Jackson Lee is that she represents a district there in Houston, Texas, I believe it is. and she's trying to propose laws that's going to affect me in Missouri or Louisiana. Now, here's the thing. She wants a law that's going to regulate how you display an antique gun in your house in a case, in a display case. Now, what the heck has that got to do with how I display my gun in my home in Missouri, in another district, another state? Is that going to affect how you are dealing with the violence, gun violence in your district there in Houston? That's the mentality of these people. They want everyone to come under their ideological wishes.
Well, they also, Sheila Jackson Lee believes that the only good gun is an unarmed gun that's useless to you. So you have to call the police. So you have to wait and see what happens. You know, you have to be at the mercy of the perpetrator that's a misunderstood criminal. You know, that's their mentality. Guns can't save lives, and we need to change that perception too. That's why the narratives are the way they are in the media.
And what if we take away that gun that's protecting her life as she travels around the country?
Well, now you're talking. Okay, so let's do that. DC Project would be the perfect group to write a citizen government firearms equality act, so that no person in government can have any more right to or access to or be protected by any firearm that is not available to the general public or the people within their jurisdiction. So if it's a senator or a representative, the state has to have equal access to firearms, bodyguard, security, and the regular capacity magazines that a member of Congress would have. For a state legislator, same thing. For a commissioner, a county commissioner, people in that county have to have exactly the same access to firearms of the same equivalency. I call it the Defense Equality Act. You can call it that. But that is critical. If DC Project's looking for an issue to go with, I would go with that amongst the other ones we talked about. You know, defense equality.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That you're exactly right. You know, why should they have a person that's equipped to, with all this firepower, if they want to call it that, but yet our schools, people defending our schools can't do that.
Yeah, you'd have a hell of a press conference if you called certain conservative news sources. We got Derek right now, so I want to get to financial stuff. But you could really have some DC Project being national, call a press conference. You know, call in the gun groups, call in, the media, Breitbart, Epic Times, you know, all the New York Post. I mean, call in anybody who might cover this properly. Have a press conference, propose your agenda. Hopefully there'll be some of our bills here too. Or maybe even, you know, we can work on writing the Defense Equality Act. You propose those. You change the debate. You know, you might get a whole lot more donors too. All of a sudden the people that are donating to the gelding Republicans will go, wait a minute, these folks are actually taking action. Could be huge.
That sounds like good stuff, all good stuff. But okay, so I guess I'll do my sign off now because I don't want to jump into.
No, that's okay.
Well,
you can stick around if you want, but if you have to go, then well, you should do your sign off anyway.
Yeah.
But you're always welcome to stay. So go for it.
This is Shirley with DC Project Women for Gun Rights. If you're interested in getting involved with DC Project, go to dcproject.info. If you're interested in my book, Heels to Holster, where I tell my story of surviving domestic violence and how I no longer am a victim because of the training and use and ability to use my firearm. So this is Shirley signing off from the Action Radio Group.
She's so good at that. Let's get to Derek. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. Yeah, I'm so glad inflation was temporary, so it should be over pretty soon, huh?
Absolutely.
Oh, I hate doing that. I love doing that, actually. So Derek, good morning. So I bet you're busy these days. What's are people walking in with frowns, disgust? Are they all panicking? Are they? I want to give personal information away, but I'm just curious the general attitude of the folks that you deal with. What's happening?
No, I wouldn't say panic. There's a few that still panic, but they're still concerned. You know, where's the economy going? Obviously, where's the retirement money going? This, that, and the other thing. So,
you know, obviously, you know, we have to address the concerns as they come along, you know, but not too many. You know, unless things can get a little bit worse than they are now, I think everybody's just kind of accepted where we are.
I haven't. I guess I know this is all contrived. This is all completely false. Well, it's interesting retirement. Before we get into the actual report here, has anybody thought to, especially the Geldings, the Gelding old party, thought to use the fact that retirements are shrinking, 401ks are shrinking, as stealing from old people? I mean, has anybody made that a talking point anywhere? Is that even being talked about on Wall Street or anywhere? Because it seems to me that as the market drops and as inflation increases and people on what they call fixed incomes, you know, that it's critical to have the dollar value as much as possible. And these folks are losing dollar value every day, given what's happening. Is anybody focusing on, seniors? Go ahead.
It does. You know, I mean, you know, there is some concern, you know, typically with high inflationary periods, you know, Social Security, when they do their annual raise, is supposed to compensate for that, you know, supposed to. So we'll see what happens this year. Last year, they got like the biggest raise they've had in like 20 years. You know, so they have been doing it. So, you know, I mean, I would say, are they keeping up with it? No. You know, but are they at least making an attempt at it? I would say mildly yes.
So, but they're not talking about it, or are they talking about it? I mean, that's what I wanted. This, no one's really made an issue out of this. You know, the Republicans aren't making an issue, or they are making an issue. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen anything, you know, that would make a big hubbub about it. But, you know, I mean, there have been articles, you know, showing concern. And, I mean, it's not like I haven't heard these concerns as well. You know, right. I mean, I've got, you know, people that have come in and been like, yeah, the price of groceries has almost doubled, you know, and then, you know, obviously the price of fuel has doubled and then some, you know,
quadruples. Yeah. Or maybe at least three times as much. Yeah. Let me see if Shirley has a question, because she may have to go soon. Shirley, have you ever talked to Derek? Have you guys ever had a chance to meet on the air here?
No, I've usually had to speed off to something else in another project, but I do have a point. You're talking about gas prices. Isn't it interesting that diesel fuel, which used to be less expensive, is now more expensive, which then drives up the cost of anything to be transported, because that's what, you know, the trucks use, which then drives up. Is that the whole theory behind why that the diesel is so much more expensive than when it used to be less expensive than regular gas?
That is a great question.
Yeah, so there's actually a couple theories on that, and I actually just addressed this with somebody else. So one theory is that obviously with growing population, you know, there's more transportation. Diesel fuel is the first product to come off the refineries, right? So therefore should be the cheapest. It's the easiest to refine. So, you know, there are some theories that basically say there's a little bit of market greed going on with that, because they're pushing the cost up intentionally, because they have to have it, you know. And then there's other things that say, okay, well, due to the rising number of trucks on the road, and, you know, and the rising number that they've increased production, so production costs have gone up. So there's a little mix of both of them. But yeah, I mean, up until golly, it was like the early 2000s, diesel was always significantly cheaper than unleaded fuel.
Yeah, jet fuel is even cheaper still, if I remember. It's kerosene, basically, the barbecue fluid. You know, that's what we're powering our jets on. But, of course, jets use a lot of it. That's fascinating. Now, in California, of course, it's even worse. A, they only have three refineries that make all their gasoline. B, they have to have a special formula because California is California. And C, they have a special trucker requirement, which went in a few years ago. I don't know if anybody's talking about that, they have to have special air filter particulate matter. Diesel fuel has more particulates, in other words, particles. That's what soot. Then we see the black stuff blasting out. Doesn't mean it's more dangerous, just because you can see it. In fact, the chemicals you can't see are generally far more dangerous. But they still have all these extra requirements. Do you see that coming to the rest of the country? Is the trucking industry, you know, going to have to go to a California model of trucks like they went to with cars, because the California market's so big? And have those regulations affected trucking that you can see as well?
I haven't heard of any new things. I mean, I know they're making improvements for efficiency and things all the time. But I haven't seen anything specific, no.
Huh. Do we import gasoline, diesel? Do we import crude oil and refine it, or do we ever import refined products already? Then we'll get to Bianchi's question.
You import the oil is refined here, and depending on, well, it's refined here, the product has a marker on it. You can take a sample of gasoline in a station in Maine or a station in Detroit, and you can analyze, you can tell who made it and where it came from and some particular formula. But what I wanted to ask, rather than giving all this money to Ukraine, why come it's not used to show up Social Security?
Or schools. Am I talking about that in the investment world?
Neither of you have to sell that to me. I mean, I agree.
And then you got Jamie Dimon that's making these doomsday predictions. How is it that they get to make predictions like that in the media, but Greg cannot make those type of predictions in Facebook without getting put in jail?
I'm a political prisoner again. I don't call it Facebook jail because I didn't do anything wrong. They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
I'll tell you a funny story. So yesterday, I have meetings, once a quarter with our reps from those companies. So yesterday just happened to be my meeting with Jamie Damon's company guy. And, I'm on the call. And, we brought up, market volatility and what's going on. And, I told him, I was like, well, it really doesn't help when the CEO of one of the biggest banks and investment producer gets on there and, says what he does. I mean, like, I agree that there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I think that there's still more to come. But, making it sound so harsh, and he's like, man. He said, "You know how many calls I've had to field today because of that?" I was like, "My goodness." So the blowback on that, I would tell you from the advisor side, is probably astronomical. I mean, like when I've got to talk to the guy the next day about comments that the CEO made in the company, that's harsh. You know what I mean? Like, there's always fallout. You got to be careful what you say at that level.
Fed does too, and Jerome Powell being an idiot. Shirley, did you have a question?
I do, because I don't know actually what was said or not, but that kind of comes into the question I was going to ask. So it's like in gun control, they have reasons for it, and they want to draw attention to certain crimes so they can push gun control. So what the CEO said, is that their way of driving Americans into more of a panic? Because my question was going to be, do you see the light at the end of the tunnel? But it appears from what you said that the CEO just kind of blew that all out of the water.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the shorter answer is should they or would they or could they? You would think that a CEO of a company like that would choose their words more carefully. I guess let me put it like this. He's not the only CEO that sees it that way, and there are other CEOs that see it differently, right? What's one from Kraft Heinz or whatever was basically saying, hey, we're seeing products that are mounting on the shelf, so we're going to have to discount prices, right? So they're not seeing the economic, hurricane, I guess, as Jamie Dimon put it. That's necessarily coming. So you get a mixed bag. It's a hard scope to see because everybody tries to make these predictions and then they end up wrong.
Well, I kind of missed this though. This is why, but I want to let everybody get a word in here. Who is Jamie Dimon and what exactly did they say?
He's the CEO of JP Morgan. He said that, the economy's problems are not done, that there's an economic hurricane coming.
Oh, I think I heard that.
Not a storm.
Oh.
Yeah, he said not a storm. He's like, storms have clouds. He's like, this is going to be like wind and rain. And, he's like more like a hurricane. I'm like.
Yeah, thunderheads overhead, folks. And it's interesting what Bianchi said earlier, and we should get to our report in a minute. Do you have extra time beyond 8 o'clock, or do you have to go at the top of the hour?
Yeah, I've still got about 15 minutes and maybe about 5 minutes extra.
Okay, guys, I just want to sort of gauge it. I forgot what I was going to say. I did forget what was going to, this happens to me all the time because I have like 15 thoughts in my head. But the predictions, the scary things these folks say, it makes such a huge difference. You know, when Jerome Powell, you know, talks about this you know, the fact that we have these storm clouds. But you and I have been saying this for, what, a year, year and a half, ever since Brandon assumed, you know, the White House was installed. We knew this was coming the minute the Keystone Pipeline was canceled. We knew this day one.
Right.
And I'm sure other people knew too. So how can I figuring that in? This is what he said was nothing new to those of us who've been watching this.
Well, nobody wants to say what's the factual thing. I mean, you can't – I mean, and I've had to say this to somebody else, like, okay, I know Russia and the Ukraine has something to do with what's going on, obviously, because they have grain production issues. You know, there's food that comes from there. There's many different things. So to say that they wouldn't have an economic problem would be foolish, right? Mm-hmm. The next thing is like when you take corporate taxes immediately from 21 to 28%, when the corporations have already had a time to kind of make things great and get a nice boom in, right? You slam mm-hmm. those to there. You immediately raise fuel costs by cutting oil production in many different faucets. You can call it, you know, drilling and exploration. You can call it pipelines, whatever you want to call it. When you do all this stuff, if you don't think that that's going to have a problem on the economy by raising prices and causing, you know, further economic problems, you're foolish, right? So, I mean, you've got all of these things and you put them all together and then just kind of say, well, you know, it's Russia. No, it's not Russia, man. It's a perfect storm of, you know, all things that were kind of put together. Well, I don't want to say all things, but at least half of it was put together by design. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was clearly designed that way. And, you know, I mean, you got to take ownership of that. I mean, if a CEO came in and wrecked his company, you know what I mean, because of a poor decision, most CEOs, I mean, they would either resign, you know, and be like, okay, yeah. I failed. Or they would be like, okay, hey, I made a mistake. I'm going to try to fix it, and here's how I'm going to fix it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, America's like a big business machine. So, you know, I mean, unfortunately, I don't think any leader would ever come up and just be like, yeah, I made a mistake. I mean, they give you that political hogwash. You know, I mean, this is leaders in the past as well. You know, and instead of doing the right thing and saying, hey, here's what we thought was going to happen. This is not what happened. You know, here's how we're going to fix it. And that's the right way to do things. Take ownership, be responsible.
Yeah, but the corporate tax and that figures in. But this is all. But well, I know what I was going to say. We had Patrick Wood on yesterday. I don't know if you heard him from Technocracy. That's his website, which is technology and bureaucracy merging. And they want to control everything. So everything that's happening now is by design. It's designed to basically ruin, you know, Western market economies and take control of everything. And the last thing they want to control is people. And that's what COVID's all about. I'll save that for yesterday's discussion. It was amazing. Let's get to the report because I want to ask you about student loans and a couple of other things. Because I know you got limited time, so I want to make sure we get those in.
Yep. Okay. Well, good morning. This is Gary Park of Ever Jones bringing you the daily financial market report. Equity markets turned around today to close broadly higher despite a weak ADP private payrolls report for the month of May. Markets are on track now to add at least to the week's rally, which took the S&P 500 higher by 6.5%. The technology-heavy NASDAQ led the way higher, up over 2.5% for the day. Crude oil prices also moved higher to $117 levels, even though, as Saudi Arabia indicated, it's prepared to boost crude oil production to offset diminished Russian output. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury yields softened a bit in the morning with the 10-year Treasury down to 2.92% levels. U.S. equities closed higher today with the Dow Jones up 435 points or 1.33% to 33,248. The NASDAQ closed up 322 points or 2.69% to 12,317. The S&P 500 closed up 76 points or 1.84% to 41.77. Again, in the bond market with the 10-year Treasury yield at 2.92%. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was up $2.01 or 1.74% to $117.27. And the spot price of gold was up $24.70 or 1.34% to $18.73. $8.40. This is Derek Clark of Edward Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Yeah, we're getting into a much larger audience now, too. So as we grow, we'll get to grow together, which is going to be kind of cool. Pianki, did you have a question? Shirley's left us, but I'm glad we got a chance to chat. Shirley does, just before I get to Pianki, Shirley's part of the DC Project, does our DC Project Women and Guns thing. DC Project's a national organization of women gun owners. And so I'm glad you guys had a chance to meet. Hopefully she can stay longer and sort of cross over these different reports. Pianki, did you have a question?
Well, you know, it wasn't just Jamie Damien that made this statement. Also, the individual representing Schwab made a similar statement. And if that is so, what do we have to look forward to? Is it going to be a Mad Max sort of situation in the United States, or just what, Derek?
Well, they say all these analysts and folks predict 9 out of every 5 recessions. So, you know, basically what that says is they're not very good at their jobs. You know, ideally, every time we try to say, a recession is impending, you know, there's something that kind of either staves it off or it doesn't even happen. So, you know, I don't like pushing doomsday scenario things to people because all it does is cause more fear. And the news does enough of that already. The news keeps you in perpetual fear, right? There's nothing that the news is ever good about. So even though that this stuff does happen, I'll give you some good statistics. We've had 13 recessions in the past 80 years, right? Of those 13 recessions, 7 of them, the market has made money in all of them. So only 5 of those people have lost, right? Of those 80 years, there's only been 13 down years total altogether. Of those 13 down years, the 7 of those 13 down years were worse than the 5 recessions. So, you know,
where did you get this from? This is interesting.
These are all statistics that the J.P. Morgan guy gave me yesterday. You know,
okay.
I mean, he was like, hey, when you have these conversations with people, he's like, this is what you tell them. You know what I mean? Like that, you know, there might, it was very interesting. And I've actually got this chart on my wall that kind of illustrates that. But, you know, he was showing me how to, you know, when people have panic and they have conversations, you know, to go over that stuff. So to your point there, Pianki, I mean, yeah, you got a couple CEOs and a couple people of major investment and banking firms, you know, saying, hey, that we're not out of the headwind. But, you know, I mean, to their point, I mean, who knows? Like, look at this. If Saudi holds true and, you know, increases production and then OPEC comes in and says, okay, we're going to increase production and oil goes back down to $90 a barrel, that's going to probably solve 30% of our problems right there.
Mm-hmm. So $90 would be about $3.50, $3.75 a gallon, maybe? Maybe $3.75? I'm just guessing.
Oh, it definitely go down you know, sub a dollar from where it's at right now.
Oh, okay, that's even better. Yeah, see, that's interesting because the markets do change and things change, and the labels that we use, I think, scare people. And I think that what you and I have talked about before, that we don't call it a recession until it's already in its second quarter, and we're already out of it. So this is such a lagging thing that if people are dependent on the labels, they're going to miss it. Just look at the prices. You know, if the price of stuff is going up, you've got a problem. And you don't have to say inflation, because inflation is actually inflation of the money supply. But the fact that prices are increasing, there are shortages, you know, the fact that our energy has been stolen, we knew what was going to happen. You know, when the Keystone was taken, when the oil leases were given up, when the land was put off limits for drilling, when fracking was done, nobody talks about fracking anymore. You know, when the regulations were piled on, all that different stuff happened to steal our oil. We knew we were going to have a supply shortage, and we knew that scarcity, you know, supply and demand. The minute you reduce the supply, you're going to increase the demand. It's going to increase the cost. Everything's going to cost more. Everything that travels by truck is going to cost more. So the price of food is directly related to the fact that we lost our oil. So we can see that. We can talk about that, but we don't have to use labels. You know, we don't have to use scary labels like inflation and recession. We do, but people don't have to go by that. They can just see what's happening immediately and react to what's happening immediately. And the big thing, I think, to answer Shirley's question, you know, what's America going to do and, you know, what's going to happen? I think people are just praying for the midterms. I think they're thinking that this is all going to be over when the Republicans take over, you know, in the fall. They just say, okay, if I can just get to November, you know, that they'll fix it this time. And I don't think that's necessarily true.
Well, they
you know,
go ahead.
these political wranglings could go away if states would merely, and it's a little bit more than just being a minimal thing to do, but mm-hmm. states need to take back their power from the federal government and tell the federal government, we're going to drill for the resources that's within our state boundaries and sell them on the market.
I think they
that's
should.
That's what should happen. Then you wouldn't have these problems. But they create these problems in order for political advantages, and not only in this, but with the guns and the shootings, and now the climate even is supposed to be a national emergency in some mm-hmm. countries.
Nah, that's just socialism. But that's Bianchi raises an excellent point. Do we have oil companies that, or do not? Do states charter oil companies to drill on their state land, which in the out west is really all of it, despite what the federal government says? Are the states to do that? That sell their own energy? That have state oil companies?
Well, you know what, Drake? I know personal individual that lease his land out for oil company. Well, in this case, is a gas company. They uh-huh. come in and drill gas on his land, and he's paid, believe it or not, he's paid about $20,000 a month.
But I believe it.
It would be what this capitalism and fair market is about. If people got oil or gas on their land, they can drill it and sell it to merchants, and everybody would be a happy camper.
Yeah.
But these
or lease,
government
lease
regulations,
the rights to it.
You can't drill, you can't explore, the hell with them.
Yeah. Well, the only place the federal government can do it is on federal land, which, of course, we know is a big problem. Well, let me ask Derek, because I know he's got to go in a few minutes. How much of an independent oil business are there state businesses? Can people do this locally, like Bianchi's saying, across the country? What kind of markets have we got that are not the traditional, you know, multinational oil companies?
I don't know the answer to that. And I also don't know if states have the power to kind of do their own thing or are doing their own thing. Yeah,
that's an interesting question. Let's look into this. Now, you know, we did a show on this. We had Roger Roots, who's a property lawyer, constitutional lawyer, great lawyer. He defended the Bundys. You know, he's one of those guys, right? And so we talked about the fact that, I mean, I knew the answer, but I wanted to confirm it anyway, that all that land out west that the federal government supposedly has is not federal land. By constitution, it's actually state land. So we that all those states out there, I did a press release on this, that all those states out there take their land back from the federal government and open it up to oil and gas and the uranium and exploration of anything they want. They could do that. I'm just wondering if anybody is doing it on any kind of level on the market. Are there any companies actively doing that? Go ahead, Pianca,
for I don't know. The information to you, Derek, the land is owned by the state. You know, the federal government job is to protect the national borders, which is about from the water edge, about in 20 feet or so. Then you're in the Texas, you're in the New Mexico, you're in the New Jersey. Those are state land. Like Greg said, nothing in the Constitution says the federal government is to own land or own property other than, well, they can own property, but other than like the forests. Like in the old TV series, F Troop.
Right.
Where the heck are we? That was always a joke. Used to be the F-bomb, but they changed it. All right, that's something that let's take a look at for next week, maybe. I'm going to look at it myself. I got a big note here to check into. Are there local or state chartered oil exploration businesses? I mean, does it have to be national? Obviously, there's a lot of money that goes in. You know, the initial cost to start an oil well is huge. But the payoff is huge if there's oil there. But only the largest companies can probably afford to drill, you know, 10 wells and then have three of them work. Well, go ahead.
Bush Sr. was a member of a cartel that was doing what was called Wildcat. So we can start our own oil company.
Derek isn't an oil dealer. I'm just sorry. Go ahead.
You and I and the financial person here, who does an excellent job, by the way, we could start our oil company and we can drill and contribute that oil to the national oil pipeline and get paid for it.
Well, it's like people that have solar panels on their house. They get paid by the power companies for the power that they don't need. Well, I think that's going to change. But why couldn't we?
Yeah.
Are there wildcat companies on the market? Do you know of any companies that
I don't.
Independent? Go ahead.
Mm.
Derek?
No, I don't. I've never even heard of it. So
okay, well, maybe we'll see.
George Bush Senior talks about how he was involved with a company, and they had an offshore oil derrick, and a storm came up and took it away. But no, it happens all the time. You know, that's the beauty of the United States until you get these damn politicians involved in it. Mm-hmm. And they just rain on your parade because you let them.
I think the answer is state chartered oil companies. I'm looking into that myself, and maybe I'll just save it for next week for our chat. But that would be fascinating to know. I mean, that's the answer. You know, the alternative to a reduced supply is another supply. I mean, that's
right,
how free market
right.
supposed to work.
Yeah,
okay.
never heard. I'd have to go do some looking. And I mean, I just don't know enough about the oil industry to speak intelligently about it.
Yeah, neither do I. We need someone. We need you to know somebody. This is like, so if you know of any oil people that want to come on the show and talk about this, I'll spend a whole, in fact, I'll give an hour outside of your regular report, but especially if you can make it earlier or whenever we do it. But yeah, we need to look into that because that's the solution. The solution is to bypass Brandon's restrictions on our oil because that'll change everything.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Bianchi.
Well, you know, my grandson's a petroleum engineer from Exxon.
Okay.
So I know a little bit about it, but no.
Well, let's get him on the show. He may not be able to talk, though.
He's always busy. But let's just face it. The only way you're going to stop what we see coming out of Washington is states going to have to put their feet down.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government gets its powers from the states. If they don't fall out the heavens, they don't come from the deep blue sea, they don't come up from a windstorm. Cool breeze. They get their powers from the states. And states could, if they wanted to, they could limit the federal government. And what are they going to do? Well, we're going to withhold your revenue share. Well, it's the revenue sharing comes from the taxes that the states give to the federal government. Ah, blah, blah. So what? They don't have policing powers. You're going to come in and you're going to police against state citizenship? If that's the case, then why don't you stop Alaska from giving royalties to its citizens from the oil that's drawn from there within their boundaries? Take it back.
Yeah. I mean, it breathes well. I'd like to see it.
I made another note to myself here to see if we can create a bill that a state, hopefully Florida, would pass a law that all federal income taxes go to the state first, then the state will pay the federal government and give them the power to withhold any money if there are unfunded mandates or coercion or other things like that. And I don't know how we'd do that.
That'd be too
easy.
We can let Ron DeSantis run it all.
Well, did you hear about my bill that I wrote, a constitutional amendment to take away the power of Congress to borrow money? Did we talk about that?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. So this would be another one that, the Congress does have the power to tax, but it doesn't say they have the power to tax exclusively, as far as I know. Let's take a look real quick. You got another couple of minutes, or do you have to go?
No, I gotta be in a little bit early, so I got to step out.
Okay. Well, give your final stuff and I'll continue with this. Then I got to play some, I haven't taken a break yet on the show. We've been so busy this morning, but yeah.
Don't repeat everything you hear here at your next meeting. Let's throw eggs at you.
I got you, man. Well, you guys have yourselves a good day. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Thanks, Derek.
Yep. Take care.
Next week. Bye-bye. You too. We have the best reporters. Jim's on a vacation right now. We're going to hear about that when he comes back. But I really like Fridays. Fridays are actually becoming one of our higher rated shows, you know, because of Shirley and Jim and Derek and Chappie when he can join us. And you, my co-host, Piaggi.
So this is a topic that needs to be talked. Whenever I speak about this, people get quiet. For the simple reason, they never conceive the idea that the federal government is working off of powers that the states allow them to work off of.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roe v. Wade, unfunded mandates, withholding highway funds, all these kind of things. The states should be in the business. So the states need to go back to apportioning taxes. Now, I don't know if that's going to require a constitutional amendment or not. It says here, Section 8, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes. So, but the Congress doesn't collect taxes. They give that, they delegate that power to the IRS. So that seems constitutional,
well,
because
like
that's part of the way they collect taxes. Yeah.
We should collect those taxes, hold them in escrow, interest-bearing escrow, then turn them over, those that are designated to the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that,
mm-hmm.
like you said, that you should put limits on the ability of the federal government to do what it's doing, running these debts up that the citizens of the state eventually is going to be on their backs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be an interesting constitutional challenge if the state of Florida, say, or the state of Missouri, said that we understand Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, we're just going to collect the money first and then send it on. So they're still laying and collecting taxes, but the states would have much more control over that point. And then they could use that money as leverage against things that the federal government is doing that aren't constitutional. Say, well, you do have the power to lay and collect taxes. That's in the Constitution. We grant you that. But you don't have the power to do this. So as a corrective measure, because you don't have the power to do this, we're going to take your power to lay and collect taxes and hold those taxes, except for those taxes that would go to things that you don't have the authority to do. Now, that would be an interesting argument.
Well, that'd be the 13th Amendment.
13th. 13th Amendment is anti-slavery. I think you're thinking of the 10th Amendment.
I'm sorry. The amendment that came on with Wilson and Philandra North, who was the Speaker of the House at that time, the income tax law. Was that, is that what you're feeling
that
out of?
That's the, I think, the 16th. No, I, let me see. 14th is my favorite. 15th, all right, 15th
was
the vote.
Amendment.
Oh, here we go, 16th Amendment. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Okay, so we need to repeal the 16th Amendment.
You're absolutely right. And I think with today's atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
You could get 37 states to go along with that.
Well,
that's a killer.
And these folks that want this constitutional
convention. And take it back to the apportionment.
Yeah. Well, and these folks, like I say, they want this constitutional convention. They want to, you know, have a balanced budget amendment. They're just tinkering. If you really want to propose amendments, go ahead.
Here's the thing. You hear people complaining about some states don't need to have two senators. Okay. Well, if mm-hmm. that's the case, let's go back to apportionment where California, since they got such an outstanding GDP, let it apportionately, whereas mm-hmm. their due tax bill would be greater than anybody else's in the country.
Hmm. Do you know why the states have two senators? Do you know why Rhode Island has two senators and California has two senators?
Oh, absolutely. It's good that they have two senators.
Do you know why, though?
It makes them just as powerful as anybody else. Is
yeah,
New York,
the states are sovereign entities. The states are sovereign. And it doesn't matter whether Rhode Island is smaller than California. It doesn't matter that Wyoming only has one representative according to their population. That's irrelevant. Each state gets equal representation in Congress by their senators. So what you also have to do when you're repealing the 16th Amendment, you got to repeal the 17th too, which says that the state that the senators have to be elected by the state representatives, because that would restore the meaning of why we have two senators.
Well, senators, I think senators' reason was to bring economics to the state. You know, if you're talking about building a car plant within a state, the first person you go to is that state senator, not the congressperson, but to the mm-hmm. to the federal senator of that state. So I think that was basically their main purpose. May not have been the only purpose, but it's a key purpose. Is that they go out and bring economics back to the state that they represent.
Yeah.
But this idea that states should take back their power, that needs to be highly considered. Being that you got the federal government that's breaking the backs of the people with this tremendous debt that they are levying not only on present day citizens, but also citizens of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Let's prevent that.
Well, that's my constitutional amendment that says that Congress can no longer borrow money. So if you had that one,
I agree with you.
Yeah. So you get rid of the power to borrow money. Okay. You get rid of the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes. It's got to go back to apportionment. Mm-hmm. You get rid of the 16th Amendment. You get rid of the 17th Amendment, which says the Senate of the United States shall be elected by the people thereof. No, the Senate should be elected or appointed by the state legislatures. We have to go back to that. And those three things would be a monumental change. And then you get rid of the withholding tax, too. You have a constitutional amendment that no tax shall be collected before it's due. Oh, wouldn't that be?
I tell you another thing it would do. It would stop states from bringing in all these illegals into their country that's being accounted for apportionment. So if you, Georgia, want to attract a bunch of a large population of illegals into your country, you, New York, mm-hmm. well, then according to apportionment, you're going to take on a greater share of the debt.
Hmm. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, you got to make illegal aliens unprofitable. In fact, the federal government needs to cut off all benefits, all everything. But what we really start needing to do is do asset forfeiture. And so asset seizure, so that anybody in the country illegally loses everything that they got illegally in the country, which is everything they have here in the country. And so that would make a huge, huge difference. I wonder if you could actually seize money that was sent out of the country illegally. Because if people are in the country illegally sending money out of the country, that money is being sent out illegally, too. It's actually theft. It's international money trafficking.
Well, you could put
money,
a tax on the remittance.
Yeah.
Asia tax, the remittance, Western Union, MoneyGram, put a tax on it.
Yep. Yeah, it'd be interesting if we could fine people for the money, the amount of money they sent out of the country while being in the country illegally. And so you're responsible for that. That's a debt. That'd be really interesting. We got to take a break. I got a bunch to do. I got to play Santa Rosa Volunteers. I got to play our Trump birthday bash piece. So we're going to be about, I don't know, about 10 minutes maybe. So Pianki, take a break. Everybody else, listen intently because that's what we do here. And I'll be back with my co-host Pianki for today. Of course, nobody's taking us up on that host your own hour thing, which is kind of interesting, maybe because Fridays are a little quieter. So let me find something fun to play for you folks, and then I'll be back in a little bit. Let's see which one do we want to do today. I haven't done this one for a bit, and actually I want to play something a little different. Let's do the Sedition Act. I haven't played that one for a bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. This week, I want to break from the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers to consider one of the many aberrations in the early days of the land of the free. That is the Sedition Act of 1798. Granted, this is always grouped with the companion bills on aliens, but I see them as separate issues. Why would a new government, formed from colonies under rules of sedition from a foreign monarch, bring about that same tyranny into our government so early in its existence? The Constitution was ratified on September 17, 1787. The Bill of Rights was ratified on December 15, 1791. So it was already in the supreme law of the land that Congress could make no law that abridged the freedom of speech, thus making any subordinate law on sedition unconstitutional automatically. And yet, it happened. All power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Therefore, if you have a government of good laws and yet bad officials who crave the preservation of power more than the alleged guarantees of freedom, freedom takes second place. You can see that in evidence throughout the entire government response to a coronavirus that would have run its course naturally in about 10 weeks, just like the flu every year, and would have been gone by the summer of 2020 when all viruses fade until the winter. And yet, look at the massive amount of power taken from the people in a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Sedition is defined in my online dictionary as conduct or speech inciting people to rebel against the authority of a state or monarch. So what did the government put into a law that so obviously came from the former ruler of the colonies into the new government of the United States? The Sedition Act is titled An Act for the Punishment of Certain Crimes Against the United States. In other words, conduct or speech that criticizes the government. Where have we heard that before? Section 1 of the Sedition Act reads, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that if any persons shall unlawfully combine or conspire together with intent to oppose any measure or measures of the government of the United States, which are or shall be directed by proper authority, or to impede the operation of any law of the United States, or to intimidate or prevent any person holding a place or office in or under the government of the United States from undertaking, performing, or executing his trust or duty, and if any person or persons with intent as aforesaid shall counsel, advise, or attempt to procure any insurrection, riot, unlawful assembly, or combination, whether such conspiracy, threatening, counsel, advice, or attempt shall have the proposed effect or not, he or they shall be deemed guilty of a high misdemeanor. This, of course, violates the entire First Amendment, except with regard to religion. It gets worse. Section 2 says in part, "And be it further enacted, that if any person shall write, print, utter, or publish, or shall cause or procure to be written, printed, uttered, or published, or shall knowingly and willingly assist or aid in writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States, or either House of the Congress of the United States, or of the President of the United States, with intent to defame the said government, or either House of the said Congress, or the said President, or to bring them, or either of them, into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against them, or either or any of them, the hatred of the good people of the United States." In other words, saying anything against the government of the United States or anyone in it is a crime punishable by jail and fines. This effectively creates political prisoners in the United States, much like the innocent people in the D.C. Gulag jail for being in the Capitol building January 6th. If that were not bad enough, within the Sedition Act is probably the most dangerous provision to individual liberty that I have yet seen in the founding documents, and provides a shocking precursor to the future neutralization of our jury system and the supremacy of the government courts over the people. Section 3. "And be it further enacted and declared that if any person shall be prosecuted under this act for the writing or publishing any libel aforesaid, it shall be lawful for the defendant upon the trial of the cause to give an evidence in his defense, the truth of the matter contained in publication charged as a libel, and the jury who shall try the cause shall have a right to determine the law and the facts under the direction of the court, as in other cases." The key words here are "under the direction of the court." The whole point of a jury is to not only determine the guilt of the defendant, the restitution in a civil case, but most important for the jury is to determine whether the laws implied are fair, just, constitutional, and are not arbitrary and capricious reservoirs of unlimited government power over the people. Jurors can do whatever they want because they are the representatives of the people over the judges who work for the government and therefore work for the people. And yet, as virtually every judge instructs their juries, that they can only judge the facts of the case and not the law. That lie is repeated every day in courts all across the country. And now I see where it came from. Section 3 is really saying that the juries, and therefore the people, are under the direction of the court. What the Sedition Act really does is makes criticism of the government a crime, and allows government judges to direct the juries that would hear any case under this act, thus destroying the right of free speech and to redress grievances against the government and to due process and the right to a jury trial of one's peers. One could imagine anyone charged under this act would be guilty until proven innocent, and then ruined by government if they were proved innocent. Can you think of any parallels to the rights of free speech today? The Sedition Act was approved July 14, 1798, signed by John Adams, President of the United States. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. This is Greg Penglis, host of Action Radio. Greetings, patriots from all across the Panhandle and from the Gulf Shores of Alabama and Mississippi. In conjunction with the Escambia Federated Republican Women, the Gulf Coast Patriots is hosting a huge birthday celebration to honor President Trump. Saturday, June 11th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Ultra Mega Festival and Trump Birthday Party at the Santa Rosa County Fairgrounds, 8604 Bobby Brown Road in Milton, Florida. All conservative groups are specially invited. Bring your family and friends for fun and games, music, food, meet and greet the candidates, pony rides for the kiddies, show off your mega gear and America First swag. This is a tailgate-style event, so bring your chairs, tables, and tents. Come celebrate the birthday of the only person to be both the 45th and 46th president at the same time, our president, Donald Trump. Happy birthday, President Trump, and thank you for what you gave us. You gave us pride in our nation again. You made America First a goal that not only could be achieved, but was. Thank you for $1.85 gasoline and so much energy we could export it. Thank you for putting us on a level playing field with China. Thank you for not surrendering in Afghanistan and for trying to end the war there and everywhere we were involved. Thank you for not letting Russia invade Ukraine and North Korea for not testing nuclear missiles. Thank you for so many accomplishments when the entire Washington, D.C. deep state and the National Socialist media were against you. So let us just say now, happy birthday, Mr. President. See you all at the party, Saturday, June 11th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Santa Rosa County Fairgrounds. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything. All right, let's make Yankee Slam line back live again. Let's get back here. We've got about 37 minutes. Anybody wants to join us? 215-383-3832. We have the live chat if you want to type in a message. Haven't seen a message here for months. I don't know what's going on with that. We also have the Skype line if you want to call us from anywhere in the world. You have to call usually the day before, and then once I okay your ability to call, you can call the show directly, and you will show up on the board here. We've had calls from Singapore. Israel, we've had New Zealand, we had Alan Dawson, Piaggi's favorite, with the latest lunch menu in Belize, which always cracks me up. But we're going to get more, and so as the show grows, we just got Indonesia has now shown up on our map, the largest Muslim country in the world, which should be really interesting if we start writing laws for Indonesians. Piaggi, how's your week been? I've had a great time myself.
Well, it's been okay. You know, one thing I ran into was it was a discussion about Will Smith and Chris Rock and his slapping. And we had a lady from Guatemala that made a comment that that wasn't nobody's business. And, you know, the discussion in Facebook went back and forth. Mm-hmm. Said, well, he committed a crime against the state. But she couldn't understand that because where she comes from, they take on a whole different attitude that if a person don't want to charge somebody with committing a crime, they got a right not to charge them.
Huh. But
the way the statute laws work, it's a statute against what was carried out. And regardless if the victim wants to charge or not, the perpetrator violated the statute and should be charged.
What do they do with domestic violence? What do they do with, you know, stalkers and predators and, you know, either partner, men or women who are abused, their male or female partners? I mean, you know,
you
the victim usually says...
Josie about this.
What's that?
Josie from Ecuador. No, she's from Guatemala.
No, Nicaragua.
Nicaragua. I looked at the Guatemala Constitution,
uh-huh.
and it's a socialist country.
Mm-hmm.
And reading the Constitution. So that's where we get to the point, Greg, that when you have open borders
mm-hmm.
and you have unvetted immigrants, mm-hmm. these immigrants come in with their own ideology on how things should work based on where they come from.
Well, because they don't come here to be American.
Stand, well, they don't, because they still carry their mm-hmm. ideology. And that can show up in the polls and other areas where they may yeah. change. They don't want all the things where they left, but they want some of the things where they left.
Yeah.
And
you know,
that's
one
what
thing, it's one thing to bring in culture, you know, and language and things like that. You know, I love Brazilian restaurants and, you know, Ethiopian restaurants. I love the different cultures that come to the United States. That's not the issue. The issue, the most important part of any immigrant to this country is assimilation. You have to come here to be American. Now, nobody cares who you, well, most people don't, but nobody really cares. The government doesn't care where you come from as long as you come here to be American. At least that used to be the way the government was. That's the way it was with me when I went through my interview. And I'm like, you know, a teenager. I'm going through an interview with immigration. It's kind of interesting, actually, because I did my homework. So I knew the Bill of Rights, and I knew the preamble of the Constitution. I could talk about various issues. I could, you know, freely without mental reservation or purpose of evasion, swear that I was not and never have been a member of the Communist Party, nor do I intend to be. You know, and I could say that honestly, openly, and I did. You know, oh, okay, cool. You know, my immigration investigator was quite happy with my interview, obviously, or I wouldn't have been able to get my citizenship. You know, but the most important thing is assimilation. You have to come here to be American. You know, One American News plays this thing at 5 o'clock where they talk about Teddy Roosevelt's quote. He says, it doesn't matter, you know, where anybody comes from. But if they come here to be partially American, in other words, a hyphenated American and not fully American, then they're not American. Now, I have a slight conflict with that because, you know, as far as Canada is concerned,
yeah.
I'm still Canadian. But as far as the United States is concerned, I'm American only. You know, if it came right down to it, my citizenship is here.
That not only applies to people coming into the country as a whole, but mm-hmm. it should also apply when people come from one state to the other. If you come to Texas, you come here to be Texas. If
yeah.
you come to Illinois, you come here to be Illinoisan. So you can't bring from Oregon, or you can't bring from New
yeah.
Mexico or from Iowa to Texas. And, you know, you may be coming from a blue state. Now you want to bring those taxes to this red state in order to change it from red to purple to blue. So that's what you have.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if that's as big a problem as we thought it was, because a lot of times the people that do come here, the people that, from California that love socialism are still there. The people that don't love socialism, like me, came to a place where America existed again, where we had a freer, not a free, obviously, yet, but a freer market, where there's more political freedom here than there would be in California by far. And I can feel it every day. I can go say what I want. I can do what I want. You know, I got my carry permit, which I couldn't have gotten in the Bay Area. You know, I express myself freely there. And two people that I talk to, for the most part, you know, most of the folks around here are conservative. So I have chosen to associate with people who have a similar political belief, for the most part, not always, not all, of course. But I think that happens, though, that when people go to different states, If they're smart, they'll do that. If they're just coming here from New York because we have low taxes and they're bringing the New York socialism with them, yeah, they're going to vote against low taxes, you know, or they're going to vote for big services, not realizing those big services come with high taxes, the very taxes they left. So you can't enforce it, though, unfortunately. It's not, you can't make a law on it. You can make a law about international. Yes, absolutely. Immigrants should be made to assimilate. That's something we can definitely control. But American citizens moving state to state, you know, you hopefully persuade them. But unfortunately, I don't think you can make you can't make a law on that, nice though it might be.
Well, you know, sometimes it worked. But I know back in early on, decades ago, say in the 70s, I know people that went to California because of California generosity as far as welfare benefits are concerned. Mm-hmm. And they left their relatives and loved ones back at, say, in Missouri. Now, if they come back from California and bring back the reason why they went there first back to, say, Missouri, well, they're going to work to change the circumstances in Missouri so it would be like California in Missouri. So
yeah,
there
is
danger.
Along with it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they don't, but if you got enough numbers, you're going to make changes.
Well, that's the thing.
See, they'll come back and live in Missouri, but they want to have California welfare benefits.
Yeah, yeah. That's where persuasion comes in. That's where campaigns come in. That's why people have to, you know, but the biggest problem we have is we don't have an opposition party. You know, we have the Uniparty, you know, and they're in the deep state power. They're not, there's no opposition to the Marxists. Well, the Republicans are basically the go-along party for the most part. Oh, there's a few people making noise, but for the most part, they don't. This is interesting. Yeah, as someone that came from California to Florida, I came to a particular part of Florida that's particularly conservative, which is where I wanted to be, the Panhandle, you know, near Pensacola. You know, so here I'm in Milton. I didn't know Milton. I didn't know anything about the place, you know, but I got a job here. So, like, here I am. This is kind of cool, you know. So, but
see,
that's
blacks
why people move.
Coming from, blacks moving from California are going to come back to, say, a Georgia, and they're going to bring back with them their democratic persuasions. They don't want somewhat, and I'm not saying all, but like I said before, I knew some that left and went to California because of what California had to offer along the lines of socialist programs and welfare, much mm-hmm. greater than what it is in the state that they came from. Same thing, for instance, in St. Louis.
Right.
St. Louis teachers go to East St. Louis, District 79, because they pay more money.
Hmm.
They pay more money.
But,
I mean,
that makes sense then. Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I'm just writing some down here real quick. Yeah, but the other example would be black folks that went to California because of the economic opportunities, which there were. You know, back when we had Republican governors, you know, Duke Majan and Pete Wilson, the foreign police chief of L.A., you know, they were boring. God, they were boring. But they were great because they fixed things. They kept the infrastructure. They tried to build power plants and reservoirs. And, of course, the wacko environmentalists stopped them. But for the most part, there were some great business opportunities. That's how high tech – that's how big – that's how Silicon Valley was created during Republican administrations, you know, from Reagan to Pete Wilson. I don't count Schwarzenegger as a Republican. He was just kind of a – He was kind of an Arnold. Anyway, but during the time when California was growing, there were incredible opportunities, economic opportunities. And so people would have moved to California for that. Now, if black folks moved to California for the economic opportunity as opposed to the welfare benefit, then they went back to Georgia, you know, they're going to want to have those same economic opportunities. So it's all – I don't know if you want to generalize, or these are just folks that you happen to know of or know. But it's interesting that that's a lot of the reasons people did move to California, because the opportunities were incredible. Once they went socialist, those opportunities went away. And I think that's a lot of the reason a lot of people are leaving. I went to California for the opportunity, but that was 1984. You know, I drove across the country from Boston and packed up everything I owned, just left. New opportunity. Let's go. You know, go west, young man. So I did, as far as I could go, and I ended up in San Francisco. I didn't know the place. I've been there one day, you know, previously. I'm based on one day when I was 14. I thought, I want to live here. So I went back with all my stuff. Stayed 30 years. It was great. Well, the last 10 weren't so hot. So people move where the opportunity presents itself, whether it's welfare or whether it's economic opportunity. We like to think people move for economic opportunity, but we know people do move for welfare. In fact, there was California tried to stop that because there was such a drain on the finances. California passed a law that you had to live there for 6 months before you're eligible for welfare. And then, of course, the liberals went to the Supreme Court, and they said, no, you can't do that. And the reason was because people have a right to travel. And the fact that they couldn't get welfare as soon as they got there was a denial of their right to travel. Well, if we have a right to travel, we have a right to travel without a driver's license, because that's an impediment. That's a restriction. That's an infringement on our right to travel, right? So I'm going to use that case one day to write a bill to get rid of the driver's license. But, you know, things have consequences when these folks make decisions. Anyway, that's my spiel. Oh, Pianki's already had breakfast. He's left. It's the middle of my talk.
No, I'm still here. I was just listening. I thought maybe you might want to continue.
Oh, no, no, it's done. I want to get to energy here a little bit, because of the second part of the show today, we covered the masculinity decline, but I found this interesting article based on what Brandon said, the insurrectionist, the installed, you know, oppressor of all things good in this country. This is from the USSA News. Veritas Libertate Scutum. I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, this is May 25th. By constitutional nobody, so these folks are anonymous. Biden speaks positively of high gas prices as a necessary part of, and here are the words, incredible transition in energy production. And so this is like Barack Obama's fundamental transformation, which he said right before the election, and very few people picked up on it. I heard it. I thought, what the hell is that? What do you mean fundamental? Fundamentally, we're run by the Constitution. So if he wants a fundamental transformation, where are we going? Well, Brandon, this proves that this has been the plan all along, which we all knew, but we're just not used to them saying it. You know, he says Americans are currently, this is the article, Americans are currently paying near record prices. Well, they actually are paying record prices now. This was last week, so it was different. Paying record prices for gasoline and diesel fuel, we talked about diesel earlier, that are due at least in part to insurrectionist Joe Biden's, that was my word, disfavorable policies towards the domestic production of energy derived from fossil fuels, which aren't really fossil fuels, we know, like coal, oil, and natural gas. It says on Monday, Brandon, my word, seemed to slip up and openly acknowledge that the painfully high costs Americans are paying at the pump are simply part of a, quote, incredible transition away from a reliance on abiotic oil, my words, that he views positively, Breitbart reports. So this guy, he openly said it, we're in an incredible transition. You know, this is, and when it's over, everything's going to be great, but we got to get better. In other words, it's like they're compelled. We have to do this to get where we want to go, and where they want to go is the elimination of what they're calling fossil fuels, petroleum, hydrocarbon fuels. And it says, in other words, the insurrectionist, there we go, essentially admitted that more expensive energy is a deliberate and even a desirable result of his insurrections, my word, policies to force a national transition in domestic energy production away from plentiful and reliable abiotic oil, my word, to limited and far less reliable renewable resources like solar and wind. And what, of course, they discount is the fact that oil is renewable. We already proved that. The earth makes it. Okay, so we're trading one renewable source that's plentiful for a, quote, renewable source that's scarce and hard to do. And this is going through an incredible transition. Now we get to the real words. Illegitimate President Biden, there we go, his gaffe on high gas prices came during a joint press conference on Monday with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida as part of the president's current trip to Asia. Biden Brandon, by a reporter about the current state of U.S. economy and its record high inflation as well as enormously high gas prices and whether he thought a recession was imminent. Brandon said no with regard to a recession and highlighted positive aspects of the economy before fumbling his response on the topic of high gas prices. And here's the quote. I'm going to stop after I get this quote so we can talk about it. Here's the situation, Brandon says, my word. And when it comes to the gas prices, we're going through an incredible transition that is taking place that, God willing, when it's over, we will be stronger and the world will be stronger and less reliant on fossil fuels when this is over. Well, when is this over? What the hell is this guy talking about? Incredible transition. When it's over. I know what he means. Pianki?
Well, this is somebody who's trying to make millions of dollars at the expense of costing other people millions of dollars. Because to do away with the natural energy of petroleum, being that it is made naturally, And the people who have been in that industry, many who have retired, now depends on receiving retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. Well, they just want to destroy those and I guess kick these people out on the street to live under bridges and fields and tents. That's what the ultimate outcome would be.
It seems like they are so ideologically driven that carbon dioxide, which is a part of the natural carbon cycle that we release into the air by burning abiotic oil, is somehow their enemy. Is somehow that they've missed their education. That somehow getting rid of what they call fossil fuels, which we know aren't, is going to be a good thing. That if we go to wind and solar, which is dependent on plastics, which come from petroleum, and the same thing with wind. You know, all these things require petroleum products in their manufacture or massive mining and massive energy that comes from, you know, the sources we all know, petroleum, uranium. Those are the basic sources of energy. You know, that includes natural gas, oil, and coal. That's what I mean by petroleum. Hydrocarbon and nuclear energy. Those are the two basic forms of plentiful energy. And the fact that
they're
getting rid of them.
Well, they don't care about that.
But you know, here's the thing. So why have they lied? Is part of this the lie that these are fossil fuels? Go ahead.
Well, I tell you why. It's because under normal circumstances, they can't compete with their product with what have been around for decades. Mm-hmm. They can't compete with those who are using the natural fuels. And now they want to use government to help remove that competition so that they can prevail and reign supreme. That there is totally wrong. Government should not be doing things that would harm one industry to make way for another industry who has been trying and trying and trying and have yet to make any headway, profitable headway, into the energy market.
Yeah, I think about all the Americans that lost their vacation this summer because they couldn't afford to go. You know, all the Americans that lost jobs because they couldn't afford, if they had delivery jobs that they couldn't afford to do, or they had to make choices. They couldn't have, you know, steak on Friday anymore. They have to, go get some lesser quality stuff because they can't afford steak on Friday anymore or barbecue or whatever they did on the weekend. You know, the quality of life, you know, when you take away energy, you take away everything. You take away money. You take away economy, you take away freedom, you take away transportation. And I don't understand this because what I don't understand, since you know I've come to know that that burning abiotic oil, hydrocarbons, are an essential part of the carbon cycle that is completely natural, completely renewable, and completely environmentally normal. Now, can you get a lot of pollution out there, and is that a problem? Sure. So you make the engines cleaner. Well, we did that. We made the engines cleaner. We made the engines clean enough that they're 99% cleaner than they were in the 1960s. That's a good thing, okay? That's the proper use of technology and the proper use of government. It's not the proper use of government to deny the fact that this stuff is good, is essential, is plentiful, and is renewable. So they have to lie and say it's like the lies of COVID. They had to say that hydroxychloroquine would kill you even though it would cure you. They said the same of ivermectin. And they did that so they could make way for the vaccines that actually will kill you. You know, so they prevented the things that cure you and advanced the things that kill you. You know, what were they thinking? You know, and this is their ideology. They somehow think this is a good thing to take away the energy that powers us, that is renewable, call it non-renewable, say that it's a limited thing, say it's a fossil fuel when it's not. Also, they can lie and push forward this wind and solar. What's so magic about wind and solar? Solar panels have to end up in landfills, and wind power kills birds and uses the very products, the petroleum products that they say they don't want.
Well,
so
these solar panels are more likely to be coming from China.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it is. You got one industry trying to move into, you got manufacturers association that's mm-hmm. trying to move into an industry that they normally could not do profitably. They couldn't go against those who basically have so many inputs into that industry, and that's the petroleum industry, energy industry. They couldn't do it, so they want to use government to help them get into a foothold, and I think that's wrong.
Well, it's an artificial market. In other words, they're not using the market. They're using the government to try and create the market. You know, it's like Solyndra. It's like, you know, the tax subsidies. They're giving, what, $30,000 rebates for buying a Tesla when Teslas came out? That should be illegal. That defies equal protection. That's a market, you know, that's a conspiracy to prevent economic – that's a restraint of trade. There's all kinds of things. I don't know what you call it officially. But the fact that the government is creating economies is wrong. That is not their business, especially when those people are contributing to them. Yeah.
They had the same thing with solar panels, too. They offered a rebate, sort of, for those who bought solar panels, and that rebate could be taken off of your federal taxes. Yeah, absolutely. It didn't go anywhere because it's just not possible to do what it's all advertised to do.
Well, yeah, and of course, China makes a lot of the solar panels. I'm sure they make a lot of the wind generators, too. So it's probably a Chinese payoff somewhere along the way. Most things are that the government does these days. I should say more about this article, and it's talking about saying the quiet part out loud. Forbes reported that illegitimate President Biden, isn't it great the way they say that? Illegitimate President Biden appeared to accidentally say the quiet part out loud with regard to the costly impact of his own policies on domestic energy production that have all but demonized fossil fuels while championing renewable resources. That would include policies like the implementation of environmental regulations that restrict energy companies, stalling on permits for new pipelines and facilities to produce and transport liquid natural gas, canceling federal leases for energy exploration, and failing to put forward a new five-year plan on leases that is required by federal law. Perhaps realizing the significance of this apparent approval of high gas prices as a necessary element of a, quote, incredible transition in energy production, Brandon then seemed to reverse course and highlight steps his administration, insurrection, has taken to ostensibly limit the economic damage of his own policies, such as an ineffective trickling release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which incidentally Trump bought when oil prices were a lot lower. It says, and what I've been able to do to keep it from getting worse, even worse, and it's bad, the price of gas at the pump is something that I told you, you heard me say this before, it would be a matter of great discussion at my kitchen table when I was a kid growing up. It's affecting a lot of families. And that's Brandon saying this, right? He says, but we have released over 257,000 million barrels of oil, I should say, us and the rest of the world, we convinced to get involved. It helped, but it's not been enough. So here's a guy that not only starves us of our domestic oil, starves us of our pipelines, starts of oil leases, fracking, and keeps control of federal land that he has no legal authority to keep control of. He's releasing our oil for our emergencies. He's releasing the Strategic Oil Reserve, which is like the ultimate hypocrisy because Trump filled it. And then it's like our savings account. So he's releasing our savings account for oil to try and get rid of the market that he's by necessity from his own ideology raised to be as expensive as possible to force us into things that we don't want. Who wants a solar car or a wind-generated car? There's not enough energy from these things. There just isn't. And gasoline is really efficient. To think that 1 gallon of gas can move a multi-ton vehicle 30-plus miles is staggering. Anyway. So that's the problem. You know, the problem is that these people are ideologically driven and everybody's letting them. And the only reason I think they're letting them is because they're waiting for the midterms. And they think that somehow that's going to save us. And it's simply not. Ain't going to be there. Bianchi?
Well, it gets back to the same old question. People need to take control of their governments in the direction in which the elected officials move, more so in the way that they want them to move than what they're doing now. These elected officials are being, we had a case here in St. Louis, right now in St. Louis. You got the board of alderman president, Louis Reed. You got two aldermen. one is Khaled Muhammad, a BLM protege. And another one, Jeffrey Boyd, who's under federal indictment for malfeasance in their positions on the St. Louis Board of Aldermen. Well, they're probably being bribed by these businesses, offered
sure
monies here, there, and the other, in order to pass laws or make it easier for someone to move into, some entity to move into an industry that they probably wouldn't be able to do if under normal circumstances of competition.
Yeah, no, this is I'm surprised there isn't some kind of a Supreme Court case already on the fact that the government is engaging in the economy outside of their authority in the Constitution. You know, they have no ability to engage in competitive economics and market changes. You know, they can regulate interstate commerce, but they can't direct it and control it. And they have to regulate it equally by equal protection. They're not doing that. Here's another article here, hot air, which is kind of ironic. It's not just electricity. We're heading for shortages of diesel, jet fuel, and gasoline. May 23rd, 2022, by Jazz Shaw, that's J-A-Z-Z, said over the weekend, we looked at alarming news about rolling blackouts that will be hitting multiple American states this summer and in future hot and cold seasons unless we manage to enhance our supply of electricity while modernizing and enhancing our ancient power grid. But electricity isn't the only form of energy that will be failing to meet rising demands in the very near future. A recent set of reports from the Institute for Energy Research digs into the supply and demand figures for liquid fuels in the coming months, and the news is not encouraging. The title of the report comes in the form of a worrisome question, like Jeopardy, right? Will there be enough diesel, jet fuel, and gasoline this summer? Petroleum product shortages may be ahead as motorists, truck drivers, farmers, and airlines are grappling with increasing demand for gasoline, diesel fuel, and jet fuel. Despite refiners focusing on diesel, which is good, in lieu of gasoline this spring, a global diesel shortage is looming. That's why I asked if we import refined products directly. That's what I mentioned to Derek earlier. Right?
No, so they refined, don't.
Yeah, they, okay, that makes sense. So they just do crude. So it's got to go somewhere to be refined. Okay. So then the market's
you know
taking
what
over here again. What's that?
Some airlines refine their own oil into their product that they're going to use.
Really? Who does that?
Well, you have to look at the big ones. American probably does it.
I didn't know. I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. Anyway, it says refiners are planning to spend the summer increasing jet fuel and diesel production instead of gasoline because refining oil into diesel or jet fuel is currently more profitable than making gasoline, despite those fuels historically being the least profitable parts of the barrel. Currently, the profit margin on distillates is nearly $60 a barrel, while the margin to make gasoline is $34. As a result, it is unclear what the availability or price of gasoline will be this summer as Americans increase gasoline demand by taking vacations as school's out. Well, see, I don't think they are taking as many vacations. I'd be curious. I'm going to look into this, too. Oil consumption. I'm being no time saver. Oil consumption.
That means that refineries make less than a dollar per barrel. It's 40 gallons of gas. Let's just say 40 gallons. I think you derive 40 gallons of gasoline from a barrel of oil. And if it's $34, really? Then they're making less than a dollar per barrel, per gallon per barrel.
Well, a barrel is 55 gallons. So of those 55, you know, it now costs $117. So if they're making 34 on the gasoline from that barrel and they're making 60 from that's $94.
Yeah, but it's only about 40 gallons of the gasoline that they derive from a barrel of oil. The others lost in other processes.
Well, let me
last time I read.
Yeah.
Maybe but the thing one. Is that this is a architect shortage that we're seeing that's basically instigated by the Brandon administration.
Now you're talking. Yeah. And like I said, this is so artificial. But I mean, I'm curious. I can look at oil trends and consumption of gasoline. I bet you it's down. You know, Americans react to higher prices by generally lowering their consumption. You know, I bet you the consumption of luxury food items. I bet you steak is down, hamburgers up. I bet you hamburgers down and maybe, I don't know, fish is up. You know, maybe people, you know, Spam, you know, as opposed to your honey-baked Virginia smoked ham. You know, people are going to make choices. They're going to scale down. You know, they're going to go from Whole Foods to, you know, Brand X. That's what people do. They make choices. People are now deciding how much to drive. I bet you they're driving less. You know, how many people are waiting? We have a lot of people that used to wait in fast food drive-thrus because it's convenient with their engines on. Well, who can afford to do that now, especially in a big truck? So they're probably going in more or they're not going to the restaurant at all. So the behavior changes. You know, when the prices rise, your only option really if you need that commodity is to use it less. You know, how many small cars are being bought?
It caused your insurance to go down too because you're driving less.
Yeah, that's true too. So that'd be an interesting thing. So everybody who's driving less, report to your insurance companies. Hey, I'm driving less. Save some money. But look at California. California has rolling blackouts. California puts everybody into electric cars, and then they cut off the power. You know, see, this is why you never want to have your only source of energy come from the government. This is my big fear with electricity, is that government, it's like single-payer health. It's like national health. It's like COVID. You know, the reason 1 million people died from COVID is because the government, you know, made policies that killed, you know, 950,000 of that million that could have been saved by early treatments by regular private doctors. All right. Same thing here. You know, we're losing all our energy. You know, we're losing. It's all because the government stole the oil. But if the government controls all the electricity, which they make with fossil fuels, what we call hydrocarbon abiotic oil, if the government has all the oil and uses some of it or all the petroleum and all the coal to make electricity, and they regulate the electricity and meter it up with their smart meters, they can ration it. And that's ultimately what this is about, is rationing your energy use.
A lot of energy companies, a lot of electric generation companies are privately held. Well, the government has nothing to do with that. It should not have anything to do with it.
No, I mean, they're privately held, but they're still utilities. They're still regulated utilities. So they may be privately held, but they're still under the government. They get their government profit. They have to go to the government for their operating stuff. You know, the power companies are in here.
They got state regulations, but the federal government has no control over how Ameren generates electricity in the state of Missouri.
No, but you look at California, and there may be state power companies. Yeah, you know, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is a PG&E is California Electricity, right? So PG&E, you know, has rolling blackouts and rolling brownouts. They shut down power, you know, when they don't have the energy. People turn their air conditioning too much in Barstow at 104 degrees, you know, in the desert. You know, and they say, okay, sorry, we got to shut you down. You're using too much power. So they shut the power down between 5 and 7, you know, the peak hours of the day.
Yeah.
That's what they
do. Yeah, well, that's California. That's not the way in Missouri. Ameren is privately owned.
No, but they're still state regulated.
Yeah, they're state regulated as far as prices. You got to show a good reason why you are raising prices that consumers are expected to pay.
Right, but it's still the government still controls it. It's still government power.
They don't
let
you raise. They don't let you raise the rates in order to build new facilities that people are supposed to pay for before it's even they're taking advantage of. They're being able to use it.
Exactly.
So in some cases, the state regulation is great.
Well, I'm not saying state regulation is bad, but what I'm saying is that I don't want my only source of power to be state regulated. You know.
I can understand that too. But you and I could start a power generating plant if we had the means to.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to do that. Well, I'm going to look up the idea of state chartered oil. And I believe in diversity. You know, I want diversity of my energy. I want to choose oil. I want to choose gas. I want to choose nuclear. I want to choose coal. I want to choose, you know, I want to have my barbecue to be able to burn coal, charcoal. I don't know if they still do that or they all gas grills now. But, you know, and I want to be able to put gasoline in my tank. Maybe diesel one day, I don't know, but probably gasoline. I want to be able to get electricity for my home. You know, I want to be able to use different power sources. I want a gas stove. I have an electric one right now. I love gas stoves, gas water heaters, electric lights, you know, gas-powered engines. Although I think a hybrid would be really cool, but I want that to be my choice. See, freedom
means... Well, here
means...
in Louisiana, we have very little natural gas appliances. It's all electric. It's probably due to... the environmental conditions for the water table and that concern. But
well,
I know that's
you don't have any mountains.
Petroleum.
You need elevation changes to make water work. You know, water works on a river.
Yeah,
right? It has to descend downhill. Yeah.
Well, the closer you are to the ocean, the higher your water table is going to be.
That's true.
You know, elsewhere. But the thing is, there was going to be a plan to build a petroleum plant down around New Orleans. And the company reneged on it because of regulations and high prices.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it's a crazy thing. But the point is the federal government shouldn't be involved. you know, the Department of Energy should be disbanded. This is a state operation. The states, but the states, you know, like I said, the states like California are regulating the power so crazily that people don't have, they don't even have their own freedom. You don't have the freedom to choose, you know, where you're going to go and when you're going to go if the government's, you know, requires you to buy an electric car and then steals your electricity. Anyway,
well,
that's it for this week.
Well, the states got the ability to say no, but they don't. They always want to come in, sit down at the table and come up with some damn compromise. No.
Well, when did they stop
no.
that?
No.
We're off the clock now, but when did they stop that? Do you think the Civil War destroyed the states? Do you think they became wimps after that? Or was it something later that destroyed the states?
Yeah, look and see when the Department of Energy came into existence. A lot of these 70s. Things really haven't been around that long. They just recently came into existence, and with them, you created a bunch of bureaucracy that causes problems for the consumer.
I would say 70s, 60s, 70s. I know the EPA came in under Nixon. I'm sure the Department of Energy probably came into the old Atomic Energy Commission. So that would be World War II. That's when that one came in.
What's
anyway,
wrong
we talk
with
about...
a state EPA? Why do you have to have a federal EPA? What's
most
wrong
states
with a
have
state,
a state
EPA?
Most states have a state EPA. You know, they just need to get rid of the federal one. But that's up to the congressmen. Anyway, we got to go.
I've done jobs.
Back Monday with Mama
I've done jobs.
Pianki,
we
got to go. We're done. Pianki.
We're done. Man, that was quick.
I know. No
oh,
kidding.
Okay.
Back with Mama B on Monday. Greg Penglis for Action Radio. RightTalkRadio.com/citizenaction. Our legislative website is www.writeyourlaws.com. WriteYourLaws. Back at our normal time Monday of 7 o'clock a.m. Central Time. Talk to you then.